Can you all hear me? Thank you. Well, welcome to this issue-specific hearing on the draft development control development consent order for the proposed Mynyth Ugwynt wind farm. I'm Philip Asquith. I'm the examining authority appointed to consider this proposal. Before we go any further, I'll ask Mr. Williams, sitting on my right, who's the case manager for this particular project, just to go over some general housekeeping points.
My name is Imre Williams. Of course, I obviously forgot. Just so everyone knows when they're going to speak into the mic, press the button in front of them. Other housekeeping rules are toilets are at the back, females on the left, males on the right. If there is a fire, which I don't think there will be, but fire exits are to your left and to my right. And if there's anyone wishing to speak in Welsh today, we do have a Welsh translator on site, and you're more than welcome to use them. Okay.
I take it there isn't anybody that wishes to speak in Welsh today or has have translation facilities? No? Good. Thank you. Right, I think it'd be appropriate to start with a few introductions. So I'll go around the table from my left, and if you could please give me your names and who you represent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So my name is Richard Kimblin, and I'm counsel instructed by David Harris, who sits to my left. He's a partner at Aaron & Partners, and whose birthday it is today. To his left, you can see Clive Callister, whose affiliation is shown on the introductions I handed around from Renewable Energy Holdings. And then to his left is Keith McKinney, also a solicitor at Aaron & Partners.
Thank you. And moving around the table.
So, good morning. I'm Tom Cosgrove. I'm counsel instructed by Clive Pinney, who's the solicitor to Paris Council. To my right, I've got Mr. Martin Carpenter, who's the planner from NPLAN, instructed by the council. And to his right, Jane Foxley, who's a solicitor at the council.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir. My name is Christiane Swart of council. I'm instructed by Emir Gwynn, solicitor on behalf of NRW. And to my left is Dr. Carol Fielding of NRW.
Right. Thank you. Is there anyone else sitting towards the back that is likely to want to speak? No? Okay. Before we go on to the business of today, just a brief word about yesterday. I'm sure that most of you knew that the intention was to have an accompanied site inspection of the site itself, but unfortunately, because of the weather conditions, not the weather conditions yesterday, but the ground conditions, the ice and snow on the site itself, it was considered that it would be too dangerous to do that. And so as a consequence, that accompanied site inspection has been postponed. There will be a session in March, when we will have the opportunity of rearranging that visit. But I can say that our day wasn't entirely wasted yesterday. We did spend some time driving around the area generally, and we visited a number of the viewpoints that have been mentioned in the evidence. So, as I say, it was a clear, bright day, and it's just unfortunate the weather conditions underfoot were as they were yesterday. Right, to the business today. Today is largely technical in nature. As I'm sure you're aware, that my role is to conduct this examination of this application for the wind farm and to report to the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change with a recommendation as to whether the development consent order that has been applied for should or should not be made. The detailed development consent order is the means by which the proposal could be implemented. Now, in presenting my report to the Secretary of State, I'll look to provide a workable development consent order, even if I were to recommend against the Secretary of State granting consent for the proposed development. The Secretary of State is the decision maker in this case, and it's important that he has a workable development consent order should he wish to grant consent. So you may participate today without prejudicing your position on the application, either in overall terms or in relation to individual elements. It also follows that today is not primarily about the merits of individual issues, but how these issues can be reflected in the development consent order. I appreciate that's perhaps not a black and white distinction, and in some areas it may be that we might get into discussion about underlying rationale or substance. My proposed structure for the hearing is to take the development consent order from the top and to work through it. And to this end, I've prepared a table including comments and questions that I have made as the examining authority and those provided by others. This was provided and circulated with the agenda. I hope everybody has seen a copy of that and got a copy. There are one or two additional ones spare if anybody doesn't have one or has forgotten to bring it with them. If I've missed any items off that schedule, then firstly, apologies, and secondly, please bring any to my attention. I intend to ask at the start of each section if there are any other articles or requirements within the draft development consent order that need to be discussed and are not listed in the table, and I'll try to take those in order. But I felt from my experience it was helpful to produce a schedule as a structure for our discussion, and as I say, my intention is to work our way through that. Recording, as is normal with this type of hearing for examinations of this type, a recording is being made, and a recording will be available on the Planning Inspectorate website. Could I ask that before any of you speak, can you please give your name and the organisation for which you're speaking? I know it's going to be a bit of a pain, but can I ask that you repeat that every time you come to speak? It does help understanding of the recording, and I'll try and prompt you if you fail to do that. There will be no written note of the hearing provided by the Planning Inspectorate. So given the numbers here today, I hope to have a relatively informal approach, but remembering that this is technically a statutory inquiry. I'm required to probe, test and assess the evidence, and providing enlightenment as to the rationale for your arguments will be the test of your effectiveness. The Secretary of State guidance is that the approach that both you and I adopt is that we shouldn't be aggressively adversarial. I'm sure that is not going to be the case today. I'll be looking for discussion with a purpose. I'll identify an initial party to speak on each issue. Often that will be the applicant initially who will be responding to comments that have been made, though sometimes it may be another party. I'll then invite others to comment. I don't plan in general to engage in any detailed drafting, but to seek agreement or clarify disagreement of what needs to be done. Where comments have been submitted by parties other than the applicants, then I proposed initially to ask the applicant to respond. If the applicant agrees with the suggestion, then just indicate, yes, you agree. I'll look to the applicants where necessary to agree revised drafting of the DCO to meet any points and agree those with the relevant party that may have raised those particular issues. If the applicant doesn't accept any points raised by the other parties, then I'll look to them to explain and then seek comment from the party that might have initially made that comment or suggested amendment. Again, if the applicant's response is acceptable, then just please say so. Those comments on the schedule in blue, I don't propose to discuss unless a party indicates a wish to do so. Those were largely picked up from the initial assessment of the development consent order. They were circulated largely with the first written questions, and I think in most cases the applicant has noted those largely typo matters and acknowledged that those might be changed. Right, before we go any further, are there any general questions regarding the process or the way forward?
Mr. Asquith.
Yes, Mr. Fawkes.
Okay. Could you tell me whether anything I say today has to be a written copy of it handed to you?
It doesn't have to be, no. There will be obviously a record on of the recording, but if once we've finished and you wish to put things in writing just to confirm what you might have said or your understanding of what's been discussed today, then by all means you can do that. I'll talk about the timetable for that when we come towards the end of the hearing. But it's not a compulsory requirement to do that, but certainly may well be helpful to me, may well be helpful to yourself. Yes.
So thank you to Tom Cosgrove, Powys County Council. Can I just raise a practical point on your agenda towards the end? There's some issues relating to noise. It's
yes.
Your item 30 and requirements 31 through 35. And so you'll know, as between Powys and the applicant, there are some technical issues. We've put forward another proposed requirement.
Yes.
And it's really just how you want to do that. And I know Leonard from Mr. Kimblin hasn't got his noise expert here today. I've got my officer here today on the chance that there was going perhaps to be a discussion, but I'm quite content to put that off to a later date and release. And really, the reason I raise it now is that can I release my officer? He's got lots of things to do rather than him sitting here all day. But it was subject, of course, sir, to you being content with that. You may have some questions of a technical nature which I wouldn't necessarily be able to answer myself on that. So can I just raise that now?
Fine. Yes, thank you. Well, clearly, I put that on the agenda because that was an issue that has been raised by Powys. I was fully anticipating that a large part of the resolution of that would take place outside the hearing anyway. So unless Mr. Kimblin, you've got any particular objections, I've no objections to releasing your witness today, your colleague today.
Sir Richard Kimblin, applicant. That's very much our view. We think that the resolution of that issue is really a merits-based one as opposed to any drafting question. Once one understands what the acoustic answer is, then either one approach to the drafting will follow or the other. And so, if I may say so, I do agree that a discussion outside of the inquiry is the place for that, entertaining as acoustics is. So we'll promote that, and Mr. Bufton is released to the sunshine, I think.
Right. Thank you very much for that. Well, thank you. I'll let you go on and do some other work. Right. Just a reminder as well that Mr. Williams has passed to me. If you do have a mobile phone or electronic device, can you please make sure that's either switched off or in silent mode whilst we're in session? Depending on how we go with our discussion. Then I'll look to probably have a short comfort break sometime in the morning. I think we may well be through by lunchtime. I don't know, but we'll just see how we go. Right, no other questions then regarding process or how we're going to proceed. Right, on the agenda I did offer the opportunity to the applicant to make any brief introductory comments. I don't know, Mr. Kimbling, whether you want to avail yourself of that, if there's anything you particularly want to say.
So that's Richard Kimbling, applicant, appreciated. Thank you very much. I don't think there's anything that we need to cover.
Right, thank you. In that case, then, can we move to look at the schedule of comments? Firstly, looking at the articles of the development consent order, are there any main articles or preamble that I've missed off the schedule that anybody wants to raise? Or are you happy just to make our way through it as it's written? Yes, Mr. Schwartz.
So I think you've had a copy of an updated schedule from NRW, which I think you may have been emailed yesterday. Can I ask if you've received a copy of that?
I've not seen that because we were here yesterday. So
Dr. Fielding has a copy she can hand to you. And what we've done is we've added various further NRW suggestions for the applicant to consider to your own schedule, which includes the blue comments to which you referred earlier.
Right. I take it this has been circulated to the other parties who have had a chance to see this. Is that right?
It was sent yesterday, sir. So whether they've had a chance to see it is a different question, but it's certainly been circulated to them.
Mr. Kimbling, any comments?
Yes, Richard Kimbling, applicant. Sir, there are some difficulties which arise from this document. We received it at about 5 p.m. yesterday, and we took the opportunity overnight to have a look at certain features of it. So the remarks which are on here fall into three categories. Firstly, some of them are helpful because they indicate agreement or are otherwise of assistance. Secondly, you'll find later on in the document set out representations previously made by NRW, so we were on notice as to those and we don't have any difficulty with those. But so there is a third category, which are essentially new points which we weren't on notice about. And one of them relates to a discussion of how the DCO is to be framed and constrained. And there are some quite detailed comments and observations in here as to how the DCO should be amended by reference to the schedule which describes the works, by reference to whether or not the turbine should be described, by reference to ordnance datum, matters of that sort. And those points are unfortunately late. They're not trailed in NRW's previous responses to the various deadlines which you've set. They arise for the first time in a document received on the eve of this issue-specific hearing. So I'm content for you to receive the document and for it to assist you in the ways I described in respect to the first two categories. But there will be points at which I regret, I have to say, that we will require further time to address the new points, which of course we will seek to do.
Right, thank you. Yes, Mr. Schwartz, have the NRA any spare copies at all that other members of the public can have a look at?
Yes, sir, we have spare copies of it. You'll be alive to the six-month statutory timetable for the DCO hearing, and that there is proposed in due course to be a deadline, I think you set currently, for the DCO to have taken on board all the comments made by parties. We provided a document to facilitate that process for the applicant and don't anticipate its concluded responses today, but we offer our thoughts on its document, which it can respond to in due course. And as part of that iterative process, there may be agreement on some, disagreement on others, and those are matters you may wish to take into account in due course.
Thank you. Anything you want to respond to there, Mr. Kimblin?
The reply which you've received is no answer. The point is that you've carefully set deadlines by which everybody's been able so far to inform you of what points they propose to take and give you explanations as to why those points are being taken, and you've been able to prepare yourself, and the parties have been able to prepare themselves and reach agreement, etc., so that this issue-specific hearing is useful. If we receive entirely new points on the evening before the hearing, which go to the description of the works, etc., that's extremely difficult to deal with, and the fact that the examination continues until May is frankly nothing to the point. The objective was for you to be able to get to a full iteration of the DCO as a result of this hearing. The answer which you've been given is one which suggests that we can run these matters out to the wire, out to the deadline. And that's, on my understanding, in the way that the examination has been set up, is not the way it was intended. And we find it frustrating that we've been put in this position.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz, clearly I haven't seen this until just now. Could you just briefly explain, with a different coloured script, just briefly explain for my benefit and everybody else's exactly what it is the NRW is seeking to suggest or do with this?
Yes, sir. The thrust of the comments by NRW are really to bring the DCO express terms into line with that which has been subject to an environmental assessment. And at the moment, the DCO terms are simply, with respect, drafted in a quite open and broad brush basis. So we're trying to bring some precision to the terms of the DCO to ensure that, because that will be the instrument that carries forwards, not the environmental assessment, because it's not attached to it, that the terms of the DCO properly align with what's been before assessed. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, in terms of the mechanics of it, wording in red is...
Yes, so you'll see we've taken your schedule as a start point.
Yeah.
You've got under column 2 article references. We've got under Article 3 organisational references, and you'll have picked up on your own schedule, which you have already, NRW's comments, which were provided to you previously. We've added further rows under NRW, also in red, where we've explained the connectivity, for example, on the first page, Article 2, the definition of authorised development. If you trace that through, seems to be quite a broad approach to the scope of development, where you've got an application for up to 27 turbines, which on its face allows you to put anywhere between 1 and 27 turbines up. And we've tried to facilitate the applicant's understanding of the current drafting and the outturn of it, so that it can take away these thoughts. You'll recall, in relation to timetable, there is an opportunity for oral comments made today to also be provided in writing after this date. And you recall there is a further opportunity to the applicant to itself provide, as it were, a final draft copy of the DCO after today, which takes on board all the comments made to then date. So in terms of my learned friend's comment about notice, it seems to us there's plenty of notice. in terms of approach, NRW is trying to facilitate properly engage to ensure that the terms of the DCO properly fall within that which has been assessed.
Right, thank you. There do seem to be quite a lot of comments in the schedule that you've made, and I think just to enable me to understand where you're coming from and what you're saying, I intend to have a very short adjournment just to allow me to have a look through this and just get my head around exactly what it is that's been suggested. Whether outside the hearing you can perhaps have a discussion between you and see where we go from here, that may well assist. But as I say, I think I need a little time just to digest exactly what's been said, so that when we come to actually go through individual items, then I'm a little clearer as to exactly what's been proposed.
Thank you, sir. We were anticipating that all of the comments made by NOW fell within Mr. Kimblin's Category 1 helpful. We're not seeking to be unhelpful.
Right. Thank you. Can I suggest then that we adjourn until 22:11? Thank you.
Can I just make one point, Mr. Examiner?
Yes, sir.
It's a point that has concerned us slightly, in that there's a whole range of deadlines here, and the written representations to those deadlines normally occur right at the last minute. They seem to end up in the process just as the deadline finishes. Mm. And it would be helpful, I think, certainly to voluntary bodies like ourselves, if it was possible sometimes to comment on those written representations and to have the ability to write to you if we feel there's a particular problem in relation to a written representation. And that could perhaps link in with the situation that we're now faced with, that it would be possible to send to you within a very short period written comments on what is happening.
I'm not entirely certain I'm with you on this, Professor. I'm not sure what you're suggesting, really.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that we have these various deadlines.
Yes.
and written representations are presented at the deadline.
Right on the deadline.
Yes, yeah. And it would sometimes be helpful if we feel, particularly as a voluntary organisation, that we're not happy with the way in which, say, our representations have been portrayed by the applicant, that we could comment on it.
Mr. Kimblin, any views on that?
So in process terms, clearly there are the written representations which have gone in, and then there's a further deadline which provided for time to comment upon them. So far as commenting on written representations is concerned, my understanding of the programme was that was facilitated. If the point is in respect of deadline three, if there is something in respect of deadline three to which the professor prefers, then I imagine that could be facilitated by an appropriate provision in respect of deadline four, if that were truly necessary. But that's the only way in which I can fit that comment into the programme as I understand it.
Right. Thank you. Clearly, there are deadlines set, and unfortunately, it does seem to be the case with this type of examination that comments, representations do generally come in right at the death, as it were, of those deadlines. All I can do is plea with the parties to try and ensure that they submit things in as timely fashion as possible. But as Mr. Kimblin said, there are built in within the programme the opportunity to make comments at each stage anyway. But I hear what you say, and I do sympathise to some extent with you. Yes, Mr. Sinclair.
Geoffrey Sinclair, Cumbria Mountains. Could I just sharpen that point up made by Professor Eris? You have produced a sequence which seems to have worked well, actually, of having representations and then responses on representations. The situation we're in, and we may not be the only party, is that we would like to make quite short responses to the comments on our written representations. So that's one stage further down the process than you have actually catered for by producing a slot for that to take part, to take place. So I think not wishing to suggest that we need a period of grace, as it were, before the deadlines. I think what the problem is that there is not a point in the process where there is provision for responses to comments on written representations. And of course, there is always the danger of going on and on and on and on, and we don't want to encourage that at all, heaven forbid. But I think since there are some quite substantial responses to our written representations, there are unfinished points there, which if there were to be an opportunity to just seal that off by making our comments on that full stop, that would leave a lot of points not hanging in the air.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Sinclair. Yes.
Thanks. Tom Cosgrove, Powys County Council. So I was going to raise this later, but seeing as the issues crept on you early on, can I just give you my view on this, so that I think that obviously the programme is set out and the deadlines are stated for a reason, and generally, of course, the applicant should have the last word on matters. That's the way the process works. And I think the distinction we would make with our eyes squarely on deadline three, to give you an example, there are some topics. I just take one example, the cultural heritage information that was submitted at deadline three by the applicant, which appends to it. Take no issue with it, but it makes the point that things have moved on since 2011 in the way cultural heritage is assessed, and they produced new, for the first time, assessments of setting and cumulative assessments based on up-to-date approaches and guidance, which is fine. But obviously, from our point of view, we would need a chance to respond to that because it's not something we've seen before, and we would clearly want to respond and give you our views on it. And that point, whether something new is produced, for example, on the public rights of way issue, for the first time at deadline three, the applicant has offered or mooted the possibility of permissive rights of way. Fine, but again, we all need to think about that. Indeed, the officer will need to go on site and look at where it is proposed and do. So there are a number of categories where we will be asking you to allow us to respond and give our views on that. And so I was going to raise this later on. I was going to suggest that might be done by deadline five. It would seem to me to make most sense, which is the 4th of March. And I say that because clearly in the timetable it is anticipated that you will be issuing your second written questions on the 18th of February. And of course you may be raising lots of issues that the parties wish to comment on. There may be issues you pick up on. We will have seen those by then and be able to respond to those, but also meet points that are new. I think that's the distinction, if there's something new that we want to comment on.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove. Any response to that, sir, Mr. Kimblin?
Sir Richard Kimblin, the applicant. Mr. Cosgrove is correct to identify that the way that matters are set up, that the applicant should have the right of final reply. That's my first point. So far as the Cambrian Mountain Society seek to avoid an endless game of tennis on this, going back and forth across the net, we agree with them that needs to be avoided. I think that what we need to understand from the Cambrian Mountain Society is what the point is that they feel has to be responded to. And during the adjournment, I'm happy to have a discussion about that. And it may be that I find it possible to agree to that. So if we can be told, then we may be able to agree with it. So far as the cultural heritage setting point raised by Powys is concerned, so of course that wasn't a surprising feature of Deadline 3. Powys asked for it. They said, well, things have moved on. Let's see how things turn out applying the new guidance. So we did what we had to do. So in respect of cultural heritage, of course, we have issues, specific hearings in March, and you've identified that as essentially a main issue. And so that is a matter for discussion, no doubt, during the course of the March hearings. If it's, I'm prepared to agree that if it's helpful for Powys to provide us with an indication as to how they respond to that document, so I don't have a difficulty with that, providing it's kept within reasonable limits and only goes to that issue. And I'm sure that Mr. Cosgrove has that firmly in mind.
Right, thank you. Mr. Cosgrove, did you want to respond to that?
Briefly, so I gave that as an example. There are a number of issues which, if you want me to in due course, I can set out, but it's the principle. I don't think there's any disagreement between us, clearly, with any wish to respond to something that's new, and only so that you've got our view, which you're going to need. I may be behind the loop. I don't think, although you've set aside some time for specific issues, you haven't. I may have missed it, because the website moves quite quickly, but I don't think you identified necessarily what those topics are going to
be. I haven't as yet, no.
So it may be that cultural heritage may not be. You may be satisfied you've got everything and you don't want to hear anything. But I think in any event, you would want our upfront response. Just for the record, sir, the issues, very briefly, there's the cultural heritage issue, there's the public right-of-way issue I mentioned, the new mitigation offered, if I can put it that way, which clearly we'd want to respond to. In landscape, you'll have seen that there is proposed, I don't think it's yet been served, there are proposed to be new wireframes on the 11th of February. There's also proposed to be, I think, from memory, a new cumulative landscape and visual impact assessment. So, again, as and when those are received, we'd want to, I think, quite not unfairly respond to them and give you our views on them. So, as far as transport highways is concerned, so you'll recall we were asking for information on impact on local Powys roads, if I can put it that way. We've been provided with some information in the Deadline 3 response, helpfully, and we just obviously want to comment on that and say, yes, that's resolved it, or no, and that exercise needs to be undertaken. And so then I think that is it. Those are the topics, the examples I would ask for an opportunity to respond to by, I've mooted the 4th of March because it's programmed in the timetable as a time by which we may well be giving you responses anyway on various issues that you would be raising, which may actually cover all those points anyway, but just in case they didn't.
Right, thank you. Well, let me ponder that whilst we have an adjournment. Seeing that's eaten into my reading time, we'll now adjourn until 10:55. Thank you. Sorry, before we do, Mr. Fox.
Sir, you'll have to forgive me. I'm very new to this process. But one thing that does confuse me, perhaps you can explain to me, is I don't understand why the DCO, this is linked to what we've been saying, I hope, I don't understand why the DCO is considered at this early stage before important matters that come out of the site inspections, other open floor hearings, the issue-specific hearings have been raised. They could raise issues which surely should be placed within the DCO.
The draft development consent order is part and parcel of the original application. So right from the outset, that's before me as the examining authority to look at. Therefore, I need to be able to consider that and put points to people. It's an evolving thing during the course of the examination. I hear what you're saying, and I can quite see from an outsider's point of view that it does seem a slightly strange way of going about it. But it is the examination is a 6-month examination, or up to a 6-month examination. The thing evolves as it goes along. And there are opportunities throughout that examination for the parties to make comments and for the the actual nitty-gritty of the development consent order to be amended and changed, and so that hopefully by the end of the examination period, what I will put to the Secretary of State is a workable development consent order that has been through the mill, and clearly my report will consider all the elements of that development consent order and explain why I agree or don't agree with particular aspects of it. But as I say, it's an evolving thing, and that hopefully there is the plenty of opportunity for everybody to make their contributions, and as I say, eventually, hopefully, to arrive at a workable development consent order. Whether that is follows from my recommendation or not, it's got to be there, and it's got to be something that the Secretary of State can pick up and run with should he decide that consent needs, should be granted. Okay. Right. Thank you for that. Then, as I say, we'll break until 5 to 10. Thank you. 5 to 11. 5 to 11. Sorry. Right. We'll make a start. I've had a chance just to glance through the schedule as amended by NRW, just to get a feel for what's being suggested. Can I then suggest that we go through the schedule, the DCO, and take it in order? Yes, I'm glad that somebody picked up the deliberate typo that Article 1 should refer to Article 2, just to slip that one in just to make sure you're all aware and awake. Right, Article 2, as it should be, this refers to the definition of maintain. That was a point that was raised by me in first questions. The applicant has agreed that additional suggested wording would be acceptable to constrain the definition of maintain. I see that NRW agree with that. Are there any comments that anybody wants to make on that particular point, that particular article? No? Okay. And the definition of relevant planning authority. I raised this partly because later on in the DCO at requirement 11, there was reference to local highway authority. This was a powers suggestion, I think, in terms of rephrasing requirement 11. And I'm just wondering whether if requirement 11 is something that the applicant accepts the amendment to it, and we're referring to local highway authority, whether local highway authority, there needs to be some definition within Article 2.
So far as Article 2 and its reference to relevant planning authority is concerned, clearly the Highways Authority isn't a planning authority, so we agree with that observation. Plainly, powers having raised the point, they don't consider it sufficiently specific. They don't consider it to be a normal practice for the planning authority to simply consult with the Highways Authority. We don't have a strong view in that respect. We are content for the Highways Authority to be involved, and we're content for the DCO to reflect that. We wouldn't have gone so far as to amend the DCO in that respect, but we're not strongly resistant to it.
Right. Yes, Mr. Cosgrove.
So I think the answer would be that if Requirement 11 is amended in the way we suggest, there would be a need to define it? So the answer would be yes on that issue raised.
Yeah. Mr. Inspector, I think the Professor Roger Ayres, I think the Cambrian Mounted Society would agree that that particular definition needs extending, because clearly the relevant planning authority is Powys County Council, but several of the requirements will affect other planning authorities who may have an interest in the development and its ancillary works. And there are occasions where one needs to talk about any relevant planning authority. And you said this wasn't a case of drafting, but perhaps on occasion, if we talk about any relevant planning authority, that would include Powys and other planning authorities as well.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimblin.
So we think that the definite article is important here, because it's pretty plain who the planning authority is. So we're content with that point as drafted. So to sum up on this point, we're content to provide revised drafting to the DCO to take account of the comment set out in respect of the highways authority point.
Right. Thank you. Moving on to, and I'm looking now at the schedule as revised by the NRW. NRW are making reference to Article 2.1. Mr. Schwartz, do you want to take us through this, please?
Yes, sir. Whilst the NRW were going through the requirements, it became evident that a scope of many of the requirements simply set out terms to provide documents in due course, which would include certain categories of topic. And there seemed to be no relationship between such requirements and the assessed environmental impacts that had been undertaken. Therefore, we would encourage the applicant and yourself to consider the approach taken at in the South Hook DCO, a copy which we also provided to you and the applicant, as I understand it, where, and also I recall was undertaken at Hinckley DCO, which is that where there is a reference to a plan, for example, a management plan, transport plan, environmental management plan, and so forth, those plans are embraced within the compass of the DCO terms. And the South Hook DCO gives an example of a draft landscape plan, as I recall. And the terms of those plans then form the objective parameters inside of which downstream decision makers can then add more detail. But the most important point that comes out of it is that you yourself, as a recommending examining authority, and the Secretary of State in due course, has before each of you today, as opposed to tomorrow, objective evidence and material on which to form a view as to what further downstream decision makers may or may not be able to conclude, as opposed to presently, the requirements as drafted include a number of provisions for plans, the content of which is frankly unknown. And therefore it seems sensible, as there are a number of plans required by requirements, and these seem to be a sort of unfolding number of plans, that provision be made in Article 2.1 for them to be included in the definitions, so that they are then embraced properly within the draft DCO. So it's a very orthodox approach that NRW is suggesting.
Yes, you refer to the South Hook DCO. I hadn't seen that.
And yes,
it wasn't a copy.
You're deemed, as it were, to have knowledge of it, but we have copies of it available, and the inspector certainly has it on its website, and the Secretary of State has it.
Yes.
And we have copies here we can hand up.
Right.
But that gives an example of an October 2014 DCO as an approach to the specificity which one might expect to see in a DCO.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, response to that point?
So, yes, Richard Kimblin on behalf of the applicant. The general principle is acknowledged and understood. You want to make a decision on the basis of a clear and certain understanding of what the DCO would comprise. So we say that you have that. You have the works plan. You have the illustrative material in the ES. And we hadn't understood to date there to be any criticism of the ES in that regard. So far as the South Hook decision is concerned, having seen it referred to last night, we've had a look at it. At present, we don't understand precisely what the point is. So we propose to engage in some discussion with NRW to try to understand what that point is. And if we can see that the DCO can be improved in some way, we're very happy to do that. But at the present moment, I'm not able to take it any further forward because I don't understand the point.
Mr. Schwartz, do you want to just respond to that?
Yes, sir, very briefly. We are here to assist and we'll continue our constructive dialogue with the applicant.
Right, thank you. Well, I think that's clearly going to be necessary in that particular case. Again, looking at the NRW schedule, Article 2, authorised development.
Yes, sir. The situation in relation to the scope of the authorised development is that in very simple terms, the statutory instrument of the DCO seeks up to 27 turbines, and it's an indeterminate number capped at 27. You will recall that the schedule, part one, defines a number of works plans, and there are a number of discretions built into the content of part one, and there are also a number of references for grid references given to some of the components but not others. Some grid references are in plan as opposed to also in the vertical dimension, and there seems to be quite a lot of unparticularization of what is being proposed.
Sorry, quite a lot of
unparticularization of right. What is being proposed within the DCO terms. So, for example, where you've got various buildings that are referred to, true it is there are in the environmental statement plans of buildings, but there's no tie at all as between those plans and the works plans. And so we're seeking specificity in relation to the DCO, which is the key instrument. The information does seem to be there in part and can no doubt be dealt with in relatively short order. But it's important to understand that it's the DCO terms that embrace the various aspects rather than simply there is some document called an environmental statement that has addressed them in some way. So it's trying to bring a match between what's been assessed and what's actually going to be permitted by the DCO. It's important from NRW's perspective because you will recall that NRW has very real concerns about landscape. You will recall that EN1, and in particular paragraph 5.9.15, puts in play, and Mr. Simon White has put in play in his evidence, the balance between landscape and need for the development, and the impact on landscape may be so damaging that it overrides need. Well, when one is looking at the development, one has to then properly define the development if you're going to properly understand the weight to attribute to the development, which goes back to the heart of please may there be specificity. If there is not, in due course, we may say that you are in difficulties knowing how much weight to properly attribute to the proposal. You'll see Mr. Simon White's written representations on landscape from NRW, who have already explained that in his view,
the impact on landscape would be so damaging, and that is the key phrase, damaging, appears in 5.9.15, and the countervailing balance is what's the development for? And therefore it becomes important to properly define and circumscribe what is it. Now, in our representations by way of the table, we adverted to advice note 9, which is the Rochdale envelope approach. Now, true it is that includes provisions for offshore wind farms, but the guidance in that may be apposite in a case such as this for onshore, because where developers have historically sought flexibility in wind farm design, the Secretary of State in the DCO sphere has already issued guidance about how that flexibility can be met with minimum and maximum parameters for example, numbers of turbines, heights, and lows of turbines, and so forth. So we're simply trying to bring and facilitate the applicant bringing what it is really applying for within the scope of orthodox guidance in the Planning Act 2008 sphere rather than in the TCPA sphere, and hence the definition of authorised development we would suggest to the applicant needs to be tightened up. So again, NRW is trying to be helpful, and we don't anticipate resolving this matter today, but if that provides some amplification to the approach, and in due course the applicant may want to consider that and come back, and if there are issues, then they'd be better distilled and clarified in due course between the parties. But we don't anticipate there'll be an issue.
Mr. Kimblin, any response to that?
So, thank you very much. It would assist me if Mr. Schwart could tell me if there's anywhere in the evidence where one of the landscape witnesses explains that they're unable to assess the scheme because it's inappropriately described. I understand the range of views which there is on landscape effect, but I hadn't understood the experts to be saying I'm not really clear what the scheme's going to be or where it is. I'd understood everybody to fully comprehend precisely the nature of the scheme, but to differ in their views as to its impact. And at the moment, unless I've missed something, I fail to see where we're going on this. But if I'd missed something in the evidence, I'm quite happy to have it pointed out to me.
Has Mr. Kimblin missed something, Mr. Schwartz?
Sir, at least Mr. White has said at paragraph 3.2 of his written representations that the proposal is for 27 turbines. So my understanding is that this is an application for 27 turbines. So if that is right and there's no issue about it, one can delete up to from the works because that's what the proposal is for.
So does that help then?
That's very helpful. So everybody understands where they are. The question is whether it should be up to or not. And I can deal with that. So one can never guarantee that each and every one of turbines will be constructible. One doesn't know that with absolute certainty. Up to is the normal way in which consents of a variety of types describes a scheme of this sort. Later in the NRW representations, you will also see the observation, well, if this is an NSIP greater than 50 megawatts, then the DCO should make it clear that it is for provision of a power in excess of 50 megawatts. And so I can indicate to you that we have no objection to that. We fully anticipate that all 27 would be constructed. But there is no difficulty that we can identify in having the words up to included. And indeed, it may be as a result of further surveys which NRW invites you to include in the DCO, that as a result of that, there is a turbine which it would be inappropriate in ecological terms, for example, to construct. By way of specific example, there's a great interest in peat, and NRW seek further investigation in that regard and in respect of archaeology. So up to is the appropriate way to frame the matter, but it's done in the context of the applicant clearly desiring to erect all 27.
Right, thank you. Well, I hear where you're both coming from, and I'm sure that if further discussion between you takes place, and that might further clarify things or resolve your specific positions. Right, Article 3.1, again, looking at the NRW schedule. Mr. Schwartz, would you like to take us through that one?
This is Article 3.1.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, this is really joined up thinking in relation to the consequences of Article 3.1 if it doesn't have the specificity. Article 3.1 is subject to the terms of the order, including the requirements. And then if you go forward to, I think it's page 11, you've got part 1 of Schedule 1, which spell out what the authorised development is. And it says gross electrical output capacity of between 81 and 89 megawatts, comprising the following works 1 to 9, and you've got works 1 is up to 27 turbines, and then you've got works 2 to 9. And then all such works to be located in the approximate positions shown on the works plan and within the order limits. So where we've got to so far is that although the environmental statement includes numerous technical drawings, the DCO itself only includes, I think it is, four pieces of paper by way of plans. One is an overview works plan, and the other three are discrete works plans. So we can put aside at the moment all of the environmental assessment information. Then if we go into requirements, requirement two says, where under any requirement details or a scheme or plan are submitted, and then there are A, B, and C, the approved details, scheme or plan shall be taken to include any amendments that may subsequently be approved in writing by the relevant authority, which we now know to be Powys County Council. And the sole proviso is that there mustn't be a materially different environmental effect. So the position seems to be that there's almost a route through to the county, or there is a route through to the county council, where it can simply, well, it appears to us, rewrite the DCO terms outside of any parameters other than an environmental effect, which seems to us to be hopelessly broad. And that's why we were encouraging the applicant to be more specific in relation to the development.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kinlan, you want to respond to that?
So this is in the category of new point. As far as I'm able to deal with it in the time that we've had, so I observe firstly that the draft DCO was with the inspectorate on more than one occasion and was carefully worked through, and the helpful advice received has all been acted upon. So the second point is that if you compare and contrast this approach to other wind farm DCOs, including in Wales, you'll find it to be analogous. So the third point is that the only difference which one finds between this DCO and some others is that it incorporates a works plan which is the means by which, for example, tracks are described. The applicant takes the view that that's the most helpful means of describing the relevant works and is much more helpful than the alternative schedules, which are frankly incomprehensible, whereas the plan is easily understood. So while we can provide examples of that being that approach being taken elsewhere, we say that that's most helpful to the user of the DCO document. So beyond that, I'm unable to take matters very much further forward, given the time I had to deal with the point. I haven't had an opportunity to look at Triton Knoll. In due course, I hope to do so.
Right, thank you. Well, clearly, you'll look further into that, presumably, and make any response in writing. Just on the question of works plan, is it work plan or works plan? I think the DCO refers to it as works. The definition is work plan. I think there is a typo, I think, somewhere where it says works plan. So, yeah, power to deviate. It's Article 6. It says works plan. So if you just have a look at that and... Yeah, thank you. Well, we move on to Article 6 in the NRW schedule. Again, Mr. Schwartz, would you like to take us through this?
Yes, sir. In relation to Article 6, there's a power to deviate, and I suppose two points really come out of this. Firstly, it's a lateral deviation, so it's in plan only. There's no vertical or there's no vertical deviation limits, as I understand it, sought presently. And in relation to limits of deviation, I understand that NRW were consulted under the Section 42 process and requested information in relation to, for example, BATs, but which simply wasn't forthcoming at all. And I think the information that has been provided is, as I understand it, so problematic that it's unable to even be properly interpreted from NRW's perspective. So the consequence is that issues are arising in relation to where one may physically put turbines that may throw up issues with BATs. As I understand it, in the different sphere, the TCPA sphere, there have been over the last year or two ordinary planning conditions that have been agreed in relation to what to do about potential BATs colliding with turbines. And NRW hope to work with the applicant to agree some form of requirement that will enable refinement or constraint on the power to laterally deviate so that that sort of risk is avoided, but we'll address that in due course. The second... no, that's it, I think. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimlin, any response to that?
So may I ask, do the County Council have anything to say on power to deviate?
Yes.
Because I wonder, sorry, if I might respond to both at once.
Right. Fine. Yes. Yeah.
Tom Cosgrove, Powers, County Council.
Thank you.
So, yes, our concern is slightly more focused, if I can put it that way, relating to turbines. And so you'll know that with our public rights of way hat on, our case relates to the contention that some of the turbines, in particular 1, 4, 7, 8, 13 and 14, are too close to footpaths, bridleways or higher public rights of way. That's the general concern. In the world where the consent is granted, and so they are in those positions, we've lost on that point, as it were, we are concerned that things should not be made any worse, so that those particular turbines don't move yet closer, pursuant to a power of deviation or commonly referred to as a micro-siting condition in wind farm applications. So the first point we would wish to ensure is that within that power to deviate, which is perfectly normal and proper in principle, that those particular turbines do not do not pursue into that power end up being located closer to any of the particular footpaths, bridleways or higher public rights of way that we have in mind relating to those, if I can put it that way. There needs to be a little bit of careful drafting of that. I actually informally just did a little bit of drafting, which is rather loose, and my friend Slister's very helpfully come back to me and made one point, but the intention would be to achieve that aim. The second point on that would be in relation to the other turbines, the other, as it were, 21, which at the moment we don't have a particular issue with in terms of their location in relation to footpaths, that as a result of that power, it didn't result in any of those being located either within 125 metres of a footpath or 200 metres from any path of a higher status. In other words, that's the general parameters we rely on in our footpath evidence. So we would want to suggest a form of wording in the article which I think probably would keep the stem, as it were, but add sort of two provisos, you know, save that those two things don't happen, and they could be drafted out to preserve the position in that regard. So that's what we'd wish to have.
Right. I think, yes, Professor.
Professor Roger Ayres from the Cambrian Mounted Society. I wonder whether this issue could be fulfilled by simply adding subject to the written approval of the relevant planning authority into the power to deviate. And indeed, there is a general point there, Mr. Inspector, that in the definitions just above, where it states in Article 4 about the procedure in relation to approvals, one could add generally a little 3 that all consents and agreements or approvals should be in writing, because there's quite a lot of statements about approval being given, and I think all these sorts of approvals should be in writing, and it may be helpful just to put that at the beginning.
Thank you. So, Mr. Kimblin, those collective points.
Thank you very much, Sir Richard Kimblin, applicant. Taking them in reverse, the Cambrian Mountain Society's points, so far as approvals are required, we entirely agree they should be in writing. Quite agree with that. And so far as my learned friend Mr. Cosgrove's points in respect to the County Council's issue on power to deviate, he's explained to you the public footpath point. So, in short, we agree. The drafting of that will be settled between us. We're content. So far as my learned friend Mr. Schwartz's points in respect to power to deviate are concerned, so as things presently stand, I don't understand the point. I'm going to try and understand it further, but at the moment, I just don't understand it.
Yes, Mr. Cosgrove.
Can I just add one point on the point raised by the Cambrian Mountain, sorry, I can't quite read you, forgive me. I mean, I don't think, just practically speaking, I think there's got to be a power for some deviation for an applicant, and I don't think Powers would want to be consulted on every single deviation for approval. I think it's a point which Mr. Kimlin touched on. So clearly we've said there are certain things which we think should be specified that would not be required, but we wouldn't welcome being consulted on every single deviation. I don't think that's the intention of these kind of orders if they're made. Just add that.
Thank you. Well, again, I think on the NRW's point, then perhaps there's going to need to be some discussion between you on that one. Right, anything else on Article 6? No? Again, looking at NRW's schedule, you raise a point regarding Article 7.1, Mr. Schwartz.
Yes, sir. This is combining, in effect, with the lack of particularity in the scope of what the order will grant. And we saw from the Schedule 1, Part 1, up to 27 wind turbines under works number 1, and that there's the authorised development in Schedule 1, Part 1 is said to be generating station with a gross electrical output capacity of between 81 and 89.1 megawatts. So it's slightly unclear to me whether one can have a kind of mega wind turbine, which might be one, which has a capacity of between 81 and 89.1 megawatts, or whether one's going to disaggregate the 89 between 27 turbines. But importantly, you'll recall that the Planning Act 2008, rather than TCPA, benchmarks an NSIP at 50 megawatts. And importantly, Schedule 1, Part 1 already expresses the generating station to have at least 81 megawatts electrical output capacity. And it seemed sensible to NRW to therefore underwrite under Article 7.1 what the parameters would be of output.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response to that?
So thank you very much. Could I invite you to take up the DCO at Article 7, where you'll see operation of generating station, authorised to operate the generating station comprised in the authorised development. So if you want then to find out what the authorised development is, so as I'm sure you know, we go to page 11, where we find part 1 to Schedule 1. And one sees immediately two things. Firstly, work number 1, up to 27 wind turbines, so I've already dealt with up to, and immediately above that, the gross electrical output capacity of being between 81 and 89.1 megawatts. So we suggest that that entirely meets the points which are being advanced on behalf of NRW. Up to 27 wind turbines producing more than 50 megawatts, so it's clearly an NSIP. And the range of gross electrical outputs is fairly tightly constrained. So from the applicant's point of view, we can see no difficulty with that at all. We really do fail to understand what more is required. Can we just also say that that's precisely the same approach which is taken in, for example, Clwchynog? It's well established.
Mr. Schwartz, did you want to respond to that?
No, sir, not at this stage, thank you. We'll continue to look at DCO terms rather than TCPA terms.
Mr. Asquith.
Yes, Mr. Sinclair.
Jeffrey Sinclair, Cumbria Mountains. I followed this dialogue with interest. Of course, because this is so considerably above the 50 megawatt threshold, in any case, there's clearly no danger of it falling below that threshold and thus becoming a casualty of the process. However, the number of turbines and the capacity of each turbine are, of course, relevant matters in terms of assessing the benefit of the scheme. There are two ways that this number may reduce. One is, or increase for that matter, one is because of the capacity of the individual turbines, which itself, of course, it's open to the applicants to vary at their discretion, provided that the physical dimensions are not violated. And secondly, by the number of said turbines. So there are two factors at work here. I'm just left wondering exactly what concerns the parties have in respect of that having a bearing upon either the benefit of the scheme and its output. Is that the purpose of this discussion? It clearly is not the purpose of the discussion to avoid it falling below the threshold of 50 megawatts because it's so substantially above it.
Thank you. Do you want to make any response to that, Mr. Kimball?
Well, so if I may say so, the points are very fairly put. I entirely agree that there is no prospect of you falling below 50 because you're so far above. The remaining point is perhaps, and I have no instructions about the particular candidate turbines that are coming forward in manufacturing terms, it's perhaps possible that 27 turbines could produce more than the stated output. But that risk can only possibly go to the benefits of the scheme, which is the point which is being made. But we're not advancing any positive case to suggest that it would go beyond that bracket. So I have nothing else to contribute, but thank you for those remarks.
Okay. Moving on then, Article 8. I think this is a fairly simple suggestion from NRW that 8.1. You agree? Good. Thank you. So then moving on to Article 11, operational land for the purpose of the 1990 Act. Mr. Schwart, would you like to take us through that?
Yes, sir. This was just to try and better understand consequences which were slightly unclear as to what's been assessed or what hasn't. My understanding of Article 11 is that it would treat not the limits of deviation, but the totality of the application red line area as operational land, and there are TCPA permitted development rights that flow from that. And I understand that in this situation, they may qualify the applicant as an electrical undertaker and therefore benefit from the permitted development regime. And I haven't yet got to a point that I've seen where the consequences of that permitted development regime as development has been considered. It may be I've missed something, in which case Mr. Kimbley will no doubt tell me it's there. But if it isn't, it seems sensible just to ensure that it was suitably considered.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimbley.
Sir, thank you. I propose to reply in writing to the point.
Right, okay. Article 12, now Mr. Fuchs, I think this is a query that you had, or querying the need for whether any trees should be felled or lopped.
Yes, thank you. Peter Fuchs, independent. So I'm concerned about the felling or lopping of trees. First of all, can I quote from the DCO, or paraphrase from the DCO? The undertaker may fell or lop any tree or shrub encroaching upon the order limits if it reasonably believes it to be necessary to do so to prevent the tree A from interfering with the operation of the authorised development. End of quote. What I am concerned over here is, will the turbines close to the Haffram plantation, notably turbines 3, 8, 19 and 24, will they be sufficiently close to suffer from excessive wind shear and give the developer the right to have them felled, even if this does involve paying compensation to the plantation's owner?
Right. Mr. Kimbley, do you want to respond to that?
So there are two aspects to this article. So we come armed with a photograph. There are some trees around one particular turbine site. There's a coniferous plantation, and that, which I'm told is turbine 9, and those trees would be felled. I don't understand there to be any particular issue arising out of that. Yes. So the other part of the article deals with the future and during the lifetime of the order, it's possible that a tree will grow in a place which has an impact upon the operation of the wind farm, and it may be necessary to fell it. That's something which is unpredictable, but the DCO caters for that. So those are the two real foci of that article, and we remain content with the drafting of it. Now, so far as there is other forestry nearby, as I understand it and instructed, the felling of that really falls to NRW, so I would ask them about it. But of course that's outside of the red line area of the plan.
Right. Does that partially answer your question, Mr. Folkes, or you're concerned about the forestry trees, basically?
I'm concerned about the forestry trees. It says encroaching upon the order limits, and they are very close to the order limits. At the moment, they are fairly immature trees, which I don't expect will affect the turbine's efficiency. But over the coming decades, they will become tall trees and may well affect the efficiency of the turbines. And this part of the DCO will give the developer the right to ask for those trees to be lopped or chopped down.
Mr. Kimblin.
Yes, Richard Kimblin for the applicant. So far as the trees that Mr. Fox just refers to are concerned, that they're outside of the land, which is the subject of the DCO. And so the article with which we're concerned, Article 12 here, doesn't bear upon those. And so in the event that those trees were to interfere with the efficiency of the turbines, that's something that the scheme would just have to live with. Article 12 doesn't bear upon things outside of the application site, if I've correctly understood your point. If I've misunderstood it, I'm quite happy to come back to the point.
Sir, perhaps I am misinterpreting the word encroaching.
Oh, encroaching upon the order land, yes, in the first line. So if a tree overhangs the order land, that's what you're suggesting might arise, might fell or lot might arise.
Well, that focus upon encroaching is helpful. Thank you very much. Really, in practical terms, we'd be quite happy for that to read: the undertaker may fell or lop any tree or shrub within the order limits. Does that help?
Would that help you, Mr.
Yes,
Folkes?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Right. Right, thank you. Article 8, sorry, going back, Article 8. Within clauses 3 and 4, there is reference to paragraph 2. There is no paragraph 2. I take it you agree with that. Right, thank you. Article 14. Any comments on that, Mr. Kimblin? That was a point I raised. You say that you're not aware of other plans that would require certification at this stage. So Article 14D could be deleted. And that's still your position.
That remains our position,
yeah.
Sir.
Fine, thank you. And then again, Back to the NRW schedule, Article 14. Mr. Schwartz, do you want to say anything on that one?
Yes, sir. I think this is picking up the... in part, your point about any other plans and documents, it being preferable to finalise and list plans that are to be, certified. There are, at the moment, I think, the four works plans only, and then there is a host of other technical drawings elsewhere, and it would be better to have them particularised in the body of the DCO itself. And similarly, this would also be the location where one would capture the various draft management plans, for example, the transport management plan, the environmental management plan, and if there's to be in due course a peat management plan, a PMP, this would also be a sensible place to put it. And again, we refer to the South Hook DCO as an example where such plans are listed out, because although these things may be in the minds of everyone present at this table, in a number of years' time, they will only have people will only have the DCO terms to hand.
Right, Mr. Kimblin, any comments on that?
So, as presently expressed, this comment is difficult for me to respond to. The way that I'm understanding the comment is that NRW are content for there to be certification of 14.1A being the land plan, 14.1B being the works plan, and 14.1C being the environmental statement. I understand there to be no objection to that, but that there is a proposal that there be further plans which should be certified. So we really need to know with some precision what it is that's proposed to be included there. It needs to be really very precise. If NRW can indicate to us what they consider should be included to be certified pursuant to Article 14, we're happy to consider that. But at the moment, we're unable to go any further with the point, having only had since yesterday evening to consider it.
Well, again, that's something then presumably that can be done outside the hearing.
Yes, NRW appreciates that precision cuts both ways, and we will respond in due course.
Thank you. Right, that deals then with the articles. We move on then to the authorised development. Work number one describes the wind turbine. Again, you've made some comments on this, Mr. Schwartz, I believe.
Yes,
sir. Do you want to take us through that?
Yes, I mean, it seems to NRW be self-evident from those two pages that there's a sort of... Well, I won't want. It's a strange, inconsistent approach because you have, for example, works defined by reference to grid references, other works not defined by reference to grid references. Some works are said to be shown on works plans, others not, and it's to try and encourage some rationalisation of the definition of the works. To again, as I've encouraged earlier, to be more particularised and more specific on the face of a simple couple of pages. And we've set out under our table simply examples of parameters that could be considered, and they're really for the applicant to consider and then to come back with.
Mr. Kimblin?
So, thank you. This falls into the category of the third category of being too late for us to provide you with a particularly helpful response, but I'll respond as far as I am able to at the moment. So if you turn in NRW's document to page 4, where there is in the body of the table there a substantial paragraph, it asserts that the definition of works number 1 is broad and incomplete. It then goes on to say, for example, that there are no grid references provided in the vertical dimension. So in the time available, we've cross-checked other DCOs for development of this sort, and we don't find there to be ordnance datum references in Schedule 1, Part 1, so it would be a departure from normal practice. In any event, the work plan is on an ordnance survey plan. Now, while that isn't a plan which shows contours, it's very easily interpolated either by reference to that plan or to an OS plan, the height at which the turbines would be placed. But there is no proposal within the application to place the turbines in any vertical plane other than on the ground as one finds it. I'm not quite sure where NRW are going with this, whether the suggestion is that the turbine would be placed lower or on some sort of elevated platform or something. But you've seen the way in which it's been assessed, and as has been confirmed, nobody has complained that they're unable to understand the vertical dimensions of the scheme. So for present purposes, we're surprised by that. If you indicate that you would find it helpful to include in the DCO a schedule setting out the particularising the heights of each turbine location, that information can be provided and incorporated, but it would be a departure from current practice, which we've sought to follow. So moving through the table, it then says works number 1 is also subject to all such works to be located in approximate position shown on the works plan and within the order limits. And the point then is taken, but the ES considers only one set of locations. So that again is normal, we would suggest. The ES assesses the scheme on the basis of the plans, such as the work plan, but understanding that there will be micro-siting within the limits of deviation. And the limits of deviation are set appropriately such that the ES provides you with sufficient environmental information to be able to assess the environmental effects, and nobody has suggested otherwise to date. So the last point which is taken in that paragraph is up to 27 wind turbines again, and it goes on to deal with the 81 to 89 megawatts point. So we've traversed that point already, and I have nothing further to add on it.
Thank you. Do you want to come back on anything there, Mr. Schwart?
No, sir, not at this stage, and we can amplify that in writing in due course as necessary. As I've explained, it's a matter from NRW's perspective of simply clarifying the location of the authorised development in its particular location by reference to works, given the particular plans that we have.
Right, thank you. Work number 2. I think,
sir.
Sorry, Mr. Fox.
Mr. Fox, Independence. In dealing with that article, we seem to have missed out the one prior to it, the one concerning the transformers at the bases of the turbines. Are we not addressing each and every one?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last bit.
Just before the one you've discussed, There is another article under number 7, which states the landscape and visual amenity assessment in the ES has been undertaken on the assumption that transformers are within the base of the turbines. We seem to have skipped over that one.
It's your point, sir. I think you raised that works number 1 provides for external transformers, whereas the environmental statement doesn't appear to.
Yes, that was a point I raised, yes. Mr. Kimblin, do you want to respond to that regarding the transformer?
Sir, yes, the way in which the ES approaches that matter is it indicates that transformers will either be housed within the turbine mast or in a small building to the side of the mast. As a matter of fact, all 4 candidate turbines which are being considered by the applicant house the transformer within the mast. But there always remains the possibility that the particular turbine which is available at the time that the proposal is constructed is one which requires the transformer to be outside. I've been provided with an indication of what the sort of thing that we're looking at. So the small white dot is the transformer at the base of the turbine. That's the sort of thing that's at issue. It's not possible for a developer of a wind farm to specify precisely the make and model of turbine which would be constructed. And so it's impossible to say with certainty whether or not that particular feature would be present. However, the point which meets the observation here is that the ES expressly says it will be one or the other. So it's wrong to say that it's not assessed. But so far as assessment is concerned, nobody from the landscape and visual experts has taken any interest in the landscape effects of, in relative terms, such minor development, when of course what we're considering is the effect of 2,725 meter structures. So in the context of what's being assessed, it is a very minor point, which, so far as I'm aware, has not troubled any of the 3 expert landscape architects who've considered the matter so far. But the central point is the ES announces the matter at section 2.7, particularly paragraphs 2.18 through to 2.7.18 to 2. Yes. So what's also been drawn to my attention is from EN3, the National Policy Statement, at 2.31 in EN3, flexibility is referred to, and it would invite you to take up that in due course. But also at 2.7.18 in EN3, the Secretary of State observes that there are many different types of turbine with and without transformer housing, and that flexibility is to be given in considering such applications. So those are the responses to the transformer point.
Mr. Oscar.
Right. Yes, Mr. Sinclair.
Geoffrey Sinclair. This does, of course, raise a wider point, unless I've misunderstood, namely that the DCO is actually heading towards the proposed erection of a candidate turbine. At some point, it will cease to be a candidate turbine. That point might not arise until the lorries move on to the site. Is that as far... and I appreciate the problem involved. Is that as far as the DCO can go to be specific about the development being proposed?
That was Mr. Kimblin responding, yes, yes, right. Thank you. Anything further on that particular authorised development work number? No? Work number two, the ES shows rotary assembly and construction areas in addition to the temporary blade storage areas. Should these be included within the works definition?
So the ES figure 6.5 has been rather over enthusiastic. An area to assemble rotors and to carry out construction work isn't needed, and so the answer to the question is no, doesn't need to be included in the definition.
So does that ES plan need to be amended then?
Very happy to do that.
Just so it's clear, I think, really.
That would clarify it matters, wouldn't it? Yes. Yeah.
So I'm absolutely clear. So that's rotor assembly and construction areas in addition to, the temporary blade storage areas is covered, isn't it? Yes, yeah, fine. Right, moving on then. Again, looking at the NRW's schedule, I think we've covered some of the next points, 10 and 11.
Yes, sir. So in relation to 11, the position there, as I understand it, is that works plan number one, also works number one, should also refer to blade lengths, because the collision risk assessment undertaken in relation to the SPA has proceed on the basis of those two blade lengths, and therefore that's another example of seeking precision in relation to works number one to get a better match, or a match, as it were, between that which has been assessed and that which is proposed to be authorised to be constructed.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response to that?
So I don't think I need to respond to that, thank you.
So in relation to point 12, there is a reference you'll see to adverse impacts on deep peat. And I understand that there is a peat management plan currently on foot, which is being considered. And that dialogue, I think, is ongoing.
Mr. Inspector, could I just add to that? Sorry, Roger Iris. The peat has been a major matter, in fact, in European law and in carbon reduction, and the Cambrian Mountain Society believes that the developers should, as suggested, put forward a scheme of amelioration or positive enhancement. But we would certainly support NRW's asking for protection in this area, and indeed for protection of blanket bog and deep peat, which they also mention. So I think that there ought to be something there to deal with the peat reduction on the site.
Thank you. Mr. Kimbling, any response to that?
Well, My learned friend Mr. Schwartz is quite correct that there is a dialogue presently underway, hopefully with a view to a statement of common ground on peat. Likewise, so far as the Cambrian Mountain Society expressed their interest in the matter, as they'll be aware, there's quite a lot of material, both in the application and in the materials generated during the course of the examination. I don't have anything further to contribute so far as the DCO is concerned. There will be matters which we'll want to bring to your attention as part of the examination on the merits of the peat issue. But so far as the DCO is concerned, we're content with the present position.
Right. NRW's number 13 relating to...
Thanks, sir. Hopefully that's self-explanatory. And it's simply, again, an example, which I hope is fairly specific, which is trying to seek a match between the DCO terms and that which has been subject to assessment. And the meteorological mast should be insured to not have guy cables because of collision risks that haven't been addressed.
Mr. Kimblin?
Richard Kimblin, the applicant. So if there are no guy wires, it will fall over. There have to be guy wires. And indeed, such would always be assumed to be the case. It would just... quite impossible for it to do otherwise.
So as I understand the position, there's no mention or illustration or otherwise of guy wires in the ES at all, and therefore if something that is physically impossible to be built is being assessed, that raises quite interesting issues, but perhaps the dialogue between NRW and the applicant might continue further in relation to those sorts of matters.
Right, okay. So continue to talk on that then, yeah. NRW 14, relating to work number 9, settlement pond.
Yes, sir, I hope that that's self-explanatory.
Richard Kimberley, the applicant. So the settlement pond was included at the request of NRW. So if NRW don't want the settlement pond to be included, then we're very happy for it not to be included. So I imagine that we can reach an accommodation on that point.
Right. Okay. So that concludes consideration of the authorised development. Is there anything else anybody wants to raise on that before we move on to look at the requirements?
No? Not from our point of view, thank you.
Right. Requirement one, I think that's self-explanatory, and the applicant, I think, has agreed with that. Requirement two, NRA, again, I've got some comments on that. Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, sir. We provided a note, which I think you've got a copy of in the email if you check in due course, and Mr. Kimblin has got it, and I don't anticipate that the matter will be concluded today. But rather in simple terms, it's always problematic trying to circumscribe properly the scope of discretion for future decision makers in relation to what they may or may not agree when the DCO, or if and when the DCO is granted, and the extent to which the subsequent decision maker is operating inside of objectively clear parameters. If they're not there, then there's a potential for changes which may not have been consulted on through this hearing process to arise. And so in the note that we've provided, we just set out some considerations for the applicant to engage with. This isn't the first, and it won't be the last DCO to try and grapple with how to define those parameters for subsequent decision makers. The concern essentially is that there is a deeming provision that if the county approves detailed scheme or plans, they shall be taken to include any amendments that may be approved in writing by the county. The only constraint is that there is the amendments may give rise to materially different environmental effects to those assessed, whatever those may be, and those may not have been consulted upon at the stage where the county council itself is making those approvals. And I would anticipate that it may be that the requirement is subject to some form of requirement, and that there may be exchanges of notes by the applicant and NRW to try and refine it. Again, we're not trying to be difficult. We are here to help, and we're trying to ensure that the requirement is as clear as it needs to be, whilst recognising the flexibility that the applicant wishes to have in due course.
Mr. Kimblin?
On behalf of the applicant, sir, the origin of the 8 years lies in the grid connection. The present anticipated date for the availability of a grid connection.
I'm sorry, we were just addressing R2.
Yes, R2, two. Yes.
We are. Yeah.
And I think I was slightly ahead of myself. So rewind on that part. So far as R2 is concerned, essentially this is an objection to a particular part of R2, and if there is an alternative means of drafting it which gets around those difficulties, we're happy to consider that. But what we really need is a firm proposal which achieves the objectives of R2.
Mr. Short.
Yes, sir. We'll try and come up with some form of alternative wording for the applicant to consider in due course.
Thank you. Requirement three, this is the time limits requirement. Authorised development must be commenced within 8 years of the date of the order. PCC particularly concerned about that and suggests 5 years. NRW have also made some comments in their schedule. Mr. Cosgrove, do you want to lead off on that one?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Yes, Tom Cosgrove, Powys County Council. So I suppose the issue is really one of necessity or reasonableness, if you like, because as we understand it, the explanation put forward by the applicant in their explanatory memorandum is to allow for, I think as they put it, the potential for slippage in the provision of the grid connection. And I think our position would be, well, that's not really sufficient. In other words, that's expressing a desire on the off chance something happens, rather than there being any particular evidence base for something being likely to happen. As I understand it, I think the published anticipated date is 2019 for the grid connection. I may be wrong on that. I don't understand there to be any particular suggestion that there's going to be slippage. Again, I may be wrong on that. So I think what we're really saying, in the context of these kind of schemes, which are said to be nationally urgent and need to be developed, we think that 5 years is the appropriate time, unless there is, of course, particular evidence to suggest a longer period is needed. So that's the point.
So, Mr. Kimblin, you want to justify 8 years as opposed to five?
So, yes, Mr. Cosgrove is quite right. There is presently a scheduled date of 2019. There is evidence of potential difficulty in that respect, and that lies in the history of grid connection in Mid Wales. The original scheduled date was 2012. It hasn't happened. And so what the applicant is concerned to ensure is that there is a reasonable prospect that the grid connection would be available within the lifetime of the DCO. Because plainly the wind farm just cannot be constructed until the connection is secured. So if I could put it in another way, if the history demonstrated, or if it was certain that the grid connection would be coming forward within the course of the next 5 years, we would be perfectly content with a five-year time limit. But that's not the history. The point which is made on behalf of the council is, well, this is nationally significant infrastructure for which there is an urgent need, therefore it should come forward quickly. We don't dissent from that at all. We are quite content with the idea that the development comes forward as soon as it's possible, but that's the key. It's not possible to construct the wind farm until the grid connection is in place. And it's for that reason that we propose 8 years. And so can we also make it really clear that we're somewhat uncomfortable, even with 8 years, having regard to the way in which the grid connection has progressed. So you ask for an explanation, and that's the reasoning for it.
Right, thank you. Do you want to come back on that, or Mr. Schwartz, Mr. Cosgrove?
I'd make the same point. I'd just be repeating myself, so I won't.
Okay.
Mr. Thanks, Schwartz. Yes, very briefly. We, NIW supports the position of the county, and in addition has the further explanation we've set out in the schedule, which is that whilst the applicant may want for perhaps commercial reasons to have a longer timescale for implementation of the proposal, the environmental baseline has potential to significantly change over such an extended period. It's well known that the whole point of NSIPs is that one gets on with the development, and coming forwards with a project that is not particularly complicated by comparison to many NSIPs and seeking 8 years seems quite an extraordinary length of time. Can I just refer you for your note to EN1, paragraph 3.2.3, which refines the approach to weight by reference to the actual contribution of satisfying the need for a particular type of infrastructure, and that we would encourage the applicant to consider bringing its project further forwards and endorse an approach of 5 years.
In terms of the environmental baseline, suggesting that it may change significantly over a long period, what specific elements of that environmental baseline do you think may be subject to particular change?
So we have in mind birds, and we also have in mind bats, and we will respond in more detail in due course.
Right. Mr. Kimblin, is there anything you want to say regarding that specific point?
So, yes, if I may, thank you. I'm not clear as to when we would get more detail in due course or what part of the process that forms. But so far as your question is concerned, could I direct you to the deadline 3 material, which we've put in respect of ecology, in which the point is made that because of the length of time it's taken to get this scheme to this point, the monitoring and surveying data extends over an unusually long period of time, which in fact for this site gives you a trend. You've got trend data in respect of this site as opposed to rather more date specific. Mm-hmm. And so what we would say is that that trend doesn't support the concern which NRW express. Indeed, it goes the other way. So far as one, of course, is always concerned as to what the environmental effects will be when the scheme is actually implemented, the information which is available to you is encouraging in that respect. So far as it's said that the applicant should amend its arrangement so that the scheme can come forward earlier, so we have to say that that proposition is absurd. We make it really clear that that's an absurd proposition to bring forward a 27-turbine scheme that doesn't have a grid connection. More positively, if either the council or NRW are able to propose a time limit requirement which relates to the availability of a grid connection, then we're happy to consider that.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Sinclair.
Thank you, Mr. Asquith. I'd like to feel a little certainty about what some of these terms mean. And I know this issue is not an unfamiliar one. Commencement of development. I'd like some clarity as to what commencement consists of. Once that commencement has taken place, are we to interpret that as a commitment to complete the scheme?
Thank you. Mr. Kimberlin, you want to respond to that?
Sir, thank you very much. May I say I'm grateful to the Society for the courtesy of raising that point with me during the short adjournment, so I knew it was coming. Thank you very much. The way in which the draft order deals with matters is that it explains commencement in these terms. In relation to the authorised development means the date on which the authorised development begins by carrying out a material operation as defined in the Act. And, sir, as you'll be well familiar, there's quite a lot of case law which relates to that sort of question. Very happy to pass that across to the Society so that they have a clear understanding of how we understand that. But it is ultimately a matter of law as to what constitutes such a material operation. Their concern is this scenario. Suppose the development is commenced, so that matters are implemented, some works are carried out, and then for one reason or another things come to a halt and there's half a scheme which has harmful effects but no benefit. What happens then? So I understand that concern, and we have already considered with others a provision for decommissioning. And it's in that context that I propose to deal with that further, because it's essentially going to a decommissioning point.
Yes, Professor Lewis.
Can I add to that, sir? And this does link with the decommissioning point, and I'm very grateful to Mr. Kimberley for the way in which he's dealt with this, because I mentioned it to him in the break, and this is something that hasn't been mentioned earlier, so I do apologise for that. But the issue, if I could deal with this time limit linked to the decommissioning, would you be happy with me continuing on that basis?
Well, as it's been raised now, yes, if you want to.
Thank you. We are particularly concerned to ensure there should be reinstatement of this particular site should there be any degradation in the event of construction and alterations to the site which then don't proceed or abandoned before completion. You've heard that we think there is significant landscape and visual and ecological impacts that this development engenders. Now, we do recognise, sir, that with an infrastructure scheme of this nature, it requires considerable planning and funding, and that the applicants and the inspectorate, and you yourself, sir, as the examining inspector, will satisfy itself that the scheme can be completed before granting development consent. So I think it's fair enough to say it's unlikely that it would be abandoned halfway through. But that is linked with the fact that we have such a long time frame. Indeed, the developer, as we've heard, has asked for up to an 8-year lead-in period, with quite sensible reasons as to why he's suggested that. But much could happen nationally within that time. You'll have at least 2 general elections. Onshore wind and its subsidies could be drastically reduced. Shale gas could dramatically alter the market. So what the Cambria Mountain Society considers is that in the event that the applicant or its successor cannot complete the project, that a remedial plan should be discussed with the relevant local planning authorities. And this would include, for example, if development consent was granted but wasn't implemented within a relevant time period. And indeed, the Society believes that there should be such a period specified in the development consent order, some sort of time limit. The legal rationale for this is my reading of the Town and Country Planning Act 1990, that the powers of a local planning authority under sections 94 to 96, which deal with completion notices, or section 215, which deals with the improvement of a derelict site, do not apply to a development authorised pursuant to a development consent order. I be corrected on that, but I think that is the correct legal situation. We would therefore like that and would submit that discussion should take place with the local planning authority on this issue with a view to a clause in the development consent order to the effect that there is a detailed landscape mitigation and reinstatement strategy that should be submitted to and approved by the local planning authority if the development is not implemented within a particular time scheme, or it's started and then ceases to be capable of producing electricity within that stated time frame. So that would be our suggestion relating to both the time period and the decommissioning. It is a matter, I think, that was discussed at a previous infrastructure planning inquiry on the Hinkley Point power station, where they did put in clauses relating to provision for a development that was only half built or didn't then produce electricity.
Right. Thank you for that. Is there anything you want to respond at this stage to that?
So, yes, on behalf of the applicants, we draw attention to requirements 5 and 6 and note that the point taken by the Society really lies between those provisions, but is not specifically addressed, and we're content to consider the points ably made by them and to look at means by which that point can be accommodated as between requirements 5 and 6.
Thank you. Right, moving on then to requirement 5, and this is a point I think raised by the County Council, Powys. R5 2B, excuse me, this is a removal of the turbine bases and cabling to 500 millimetres below ground level. The Council suggesting that this should be to 1 metre. Yes, Mr.
So
Cosgrove.
It is, I mean, that is right, sir, and that is the difference. I mean, I hesitate to say that is the normal practice because I'd probably be corrected, but that is certainly, it is certainly a debate that has been had before at major wind farm proposals, certainly in Wales last year, at the Mid Wales Cojoin Inquiry. I think this was an issue that Powys asked for 1 metre as well. And just for example, I think in the Clochynog DCO, it's 1 metre as it happens. The basis, but I know we're supported by NRW, who've provided some perhaps NRW kind of evidence to satisfy best than I could about the benefits of 1 metre as opposed to 50 centimetres, which is perhaps obvious in any event, but that we really ask for 1 metre rather than 50 on that basis.
Mr. Kimblin, any response to that?
Thank you, sir. On behalf of the applicant, the position that we adopt is that the approach should be very much in line with best practice and best practice at the time. So we note that there is some Scottish Natural Heritage guidance. It's a report number 591, which deals with restoration and decommissioning of onshore wind farms. That's the best practice at the moment, quite what the best practice would be in 25 or 33 years' time is something that we don't know. So our proposal is in principle based on that sort of approach. What one learns from the SNH material is that a rather more case-specific approach is appropriate, so that one identifies the decommissioning option which has the lowest environmental impact. And that may be removal of nothing, it may be removal of quite a lot, depending upon soil conditions. So but we don't agree that a uniform removal to 1 metre depth approach is appropriate in environmental terms more generally. So what we propose is a decommissioning plan to be agreed at the relevant time, and the relevant assessment and guidance at that time to be used to inform the decision.
Would that, Mr. Cosgrove, would that suggestion satisfy the council?
Yes, I mean, obviously the new wording will come forward, I think, as a result of that. We'll certainly have a look at that, sir, and that would make sense. That obviously anticipates it could be more or less.
Thank you. The other point, I think, on R5 that the council raises is the you want to discuss the appropriate method of securing site decommissioning and restoration.
So it's really a financial issue. Could I just have passed up to you one small thing which I've circulated to NRW and Mr. Kimley this morning, and I'll just give a copy to, if you'd mind sharing. Sorry, I've only got one extra to the other parties. It's really just to pick up on this point. And again, this is something that has been traversed at wind farm inquiries before, of the situation which one hopes never happens, but where the undertaker may be in financial difficulty, or the person that the undertaker's transferred the benefit to may be in financial difficulty, and therefore there's no money, as it were, at the end of the day to remove the turbines, which is an expensive business. And so I've passed you, sir, is a form of wording that was agreed in a series of statements of common ground at the Mid Wales Cojourn inquiry between, I think I'm right in saying, all the five applicants at that stage. It's been slightly amended by me to replace the shells with the maize and the musts. It's still not in final form and it still has some problems. But the idea on that one, as you'll see, sir, is to require details of a financial instrument such as an escrow account to be submitted in the way set out there, and then goes on to say that no development may take place until all that's been approved. So in other words, it is one way of perhaps many of securing there is perhaps financial provision at the end of the day. It could equally be done by a 106, and some may, and so you may have a view that perhaps it should be better done by the 106 1A provision. But what we want to raise at this stage is the mechanism or the principle of it being secured in some way.
Mr. Kimblin, I take it you've seen that and had some time to think about it.
So yes, Do you want to respond? We have. Thank you very much. We have no objection in principle. We're grateful for the start of 10 in terms of the drafting. And I anticipate we'll agree.
Thank you. Yes, Article 5, still on that. Mr. Folks, I think you queried the funding arrangements. I wasn't entirely clear as to exactly what it was that you were concerned about, but would you like to speak on that?
Yes. Peter Fax, Independent. Mr. Cosgrove has preempted me. What I was going to suggest was that the developer lays down a bond of some form to actually pay for decommissioning and restoration of the site. And as you previously said, there is guidance here from the SNH Commission Report 591/2013 as to bonding arrangements. So thank you for doing it for me.
Right. So something along the lines that the council
so.
Suggested you're happy with.
Yeah.
Good. Right, still on requirement 5, NRW's raised various points on that. Do you want to take us through those, Mr. Schwab?
Yes, sir. Just in relation to, I think, concluding with the top of page 6, just after Mr. Fuchs's queries funding arrangements, you'll see that NRW supports the county's approach. Mm-hmm. And obviously NRW supports a flexible approach, as the applicant does, and also NRW is able to shed light in relation to a site-specific approach. And as the county council has indicated just now, perhaps up or down from the point 5 will be helpful, and therefore maybe the parties can ultimately agree to a provision for example, quote, between 0.5 and 1 metres, unquote, which would allow sufficient flexibility, but also in relation to a site-specific provision, and at the same time accommodate future best practice in 25 years' time, then operating within those two parameters.
Right. So did you want to then take us through what you're suggesting in regarding requirement 5?
Yes, an item NRW 16, as it were, there's a requirement in relation to access tracks. And as our table summarises, we consider the access tracks also should be decommissioned because if they aren't, that raises potential habitat regulation assessments for the River Wye SAC. There is no provision for surveys to inform the decommissioning plan, and decommissioning may have as many impacts on ecology and the River SAC as construction. but there are no surveys or assessments to inform mitigation. The applicant has helpfully submitted, again quite recently, on the 18th of January 2015, a draft surface water management plan. And that appears to us to acknowledge that surface water monitoring will be required during decommissioning. And Table 10 of the amended HRASR, which was received just before Christmas on the 15th of December 2014, in time for your deadline there, includes also a need for pre-commencement ecological surveys to inform decommissioning mitigation. So the outturn of those that summary is that if update ecological surveys are required, then agreement of a decommissioning plan 12 months before the commencement of decommissioning may not allow adequate time for surveys to be completed prior to commencement. So I think it's another example of NRW continuing to try to work with the applicant and vice versa in relation to rationalising that and its terms and the content.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response to those points?
Thank you. So we've given some consideration to this in the time that we've had it. So my response is necessarily limited in that respect. But the thrust of my response is rather similar to that in respect of decommissioning generally, which is that the appropriate environmental option is something best determined at the time that the decision falls to be made. That may be that tracks need to be removed. It may be otherwise. So, secondly, so far as references made to surveys, so we regard as implicit in that process of agreement at that time that one will arrive at the decision based upon appropriate evidence, which will include such surveys as are necessary. But so that's not something which is capable of prescription at this stage, perhaps 30 years away. So one understands the sentiment and the principle behind these observations, but the applicant considers that the DCO properly captures the approach to be taken and provides for sufficient flexibility in due course for the appropriate environmental option to be identified. So we don't accept that it necessarily follows that if it is possible that a track will remain, that that's something that then requires a further assessment as to what the environmental effect would be on the River Wye in 30 years' time of leaving a track in place, the condition of which we simply do not know. It may have completely naturalised, it may be in a state which requires removal, but we just don't, with the best will in the world, 30 years away, we just don't know.
Right, thank you. Requirement six. County Council have suggested amended wording on that one. And I think the applicant's happy to agree that. Right. NRW, though, in relation to requirement six, again, some comments there, Mr. Schwart.
Yes, so I hope that the self-explanatory, there's no provision in requirement six to undertake ecological or hydrological surveys to identify any necessary mitigation for removal of failed turbines, and that will be required, in our view, to potentially avoid effects on protected species, breeding birds and the River Wye SAC. If all of however many turbines were ultimately built failed before year 25, there's potential for the whole lot to be removed. And the impacts could be similar to that to be anticipated during construction. simply in reverse. But again, that may fall into the process of an ongoing dialogue between NRW and the applicant.
Right. Mr. Kimblin, any comments on that?
So we consider this observation, particularly the observation as to all turbines failing, to be unrealistic. There's no evidence of widespread turbine failure. What typically happens is that a particular component of a turbine may need attention, but turbines themselves don't fail. Sometimes a blade might break, for example. That might need to be replaced. But there's simply no evidential basis for turbine after turbine failing. And the idea that 27 would fail, we say, is wholly unrealistic. So overall, we're content that the provisions of R6 appropriately capture the necessary provisions in respect of turbine failure. So we have nothing further to add on that. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Sinclair.
Thank you, Geoffrey Sinclair. No one is suggesting mass failure and complete failure of 27 turbines, of course, although very occasionally we've all seen it in the media for one reason or another, turbines do fail catastrophically. But my assumption was that if a turbine or a substantial part of it fails, it's replaced. That being so, of course, there are unforeseen consequences of doing that. If that happens, are we to assume that as far as is possible at the time, an identical turbine would be replaced if there were a single catastrophic failure, for example?
Richard Kimblin on behalf of the applicant. Yes, Mr. Sinclair, that's exactly right. The DCO would provide for turbines which fit the description, and so you would get back a turbine which similarly fits the description and not something different. So the answer is yes.
Right, thank you. Moving on to requirement 8. PCC have suggested some revised wording for that. Mr. Kimblin, have you any comments on the PCC's suggested wording?
So yes, Richard Kimblin, applicant. So far as the wording is concerned, we have been in some discussion on this point. The detail of what's agreed and isn't agreed is something that we'd like to get a further opportunity to discuss with the parties that take that point up with us. So far as the detail of that is concerned, we anticipate that it won't result in substantial disagreement, but I would prefer not to venture into detailed discussion of moving words around in the DCO. If that approach is acceptable to those parties who have a particular interest in this topic, then that's the approach I'd like to take.
Right. Mr. Cosgrove, any...
Yes, so shall I just helpfully give you the reason why, because it's a theme. This proposed amendment, I think, is repeated in several of the other requirements.
Yes, I noticed that.
It's really the two, looking at 8.1, I think we work from the principle in these consent orders as perhaps slightly as distinct from a planning permission, that if there is a relevant body that's capable of dealing with something, you might properly name them, rather than, as is the norm perhaps in planning permissions, to leave it all to the planning authority. The other one is a practical point of view, to be blunt, sir. From the local authority's point of view, we are openly shifting, in a sense, the burden to the applicant to, rather than, you know, come to us and then we go off and consult people, that they consult those people direct, which to be blunt, makes it easier for the hard-pressed planning authority. So that's the reason underlying one. So far as the second part, which relates to J and the little one and two, I think I'm entirely upset, Mr. Kimlin, these are points of detail, which I don't think are going to cause a lot of problem, particularly if one actually reads the list, as I read, that list as not being a closed list, so arguably it's the kind of thing that could be required before approval anyway, so I think it speaks for itself, and we can no doubt resolve that outside of the hearing.
Thank you.
I'm grateful for that response. Having seen the detail of the discussion that's gone on it, I think it's perhaps best for us all if we take that approach.
Right, thank you.
Mr. Asquith, I wonder, Roger Iris from the Cambridge Mad Society, I wonder whether in this respect one ought to consider it being approved by any relevant planning authority. This traffic is going to go through quite a lot of adjoining planning authorities, and it could cause quite a degree of disruption. I don't know whether that is covered by being in consultation with the Department for Transport of the Welsh Government, whether they, in fact, would ensure that any relevant planning authority was dealt with.
Yes, Mr. Cosgrove.
I think this is Tom Cosgrove. Powers. I think the point would be dealt with by, firstly, reference to the Welsh Government, but also reference to any relevant highway authority, which there may be more than one, because they would be consulted as is relevant. And then, in other words, you'd cover all the relevant, I think, highway authorities, the larger and the smaller roads, and then you'd come back to the relevant planning authorities. I think the point would be covered.
Right. I think it goes back to the point I raised early on about definitions and relevant planning authority, relevant highway authority as well, isn't it? Ceredigion and County Council has raised a point on R81. Was there anything you wanted to respond there, Mr. Kimblin?
The point which is made is one concerning off-site highway works. If we turn up the particular point taken in respect of 8.1, we turn it up in the DCO. Listing there the matters set out at A through to J in respect of the CTMP. Their proposal for an implementation plan and specification of temporary road closures is something which we would say is captured within the plan in any event. So we don't think there's a need to make any amendment there, but we, so far as that's an effect which needs to be addressed, we think it will be captured within the management plan in any event. And so far as those points overlap with any detailed drafting points which are under discussion between the County Council and ourselves, we don't think that those points will be we don't think that Ceredigion's point will be adversely affected by that drafting. So in summary, captured by the management plan, secondly, not affected by any changes likely to come forward as a result of discussions between ourselves and Powys.
Right, thank you. NRW have some comments. Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, so it goes back to the being more particularised, which, as I said, cuts both ways, and the approach of NRW to incorporating expressly such draft management plans as are within the six-month DCO hearing compass, not only is the objective evidence on which you can anticipate and make recommendations into in relation to future decisions by downstream decision makers, but also that in relation to those downstream decision makers, they themselves have a document which they can refer back to as the detail which will be populated by the various items under 8.1, 9.1 and so forth. Can I just flag up in connection to that the potential relation of that approach to, I think it was, the certification of plans at 14. The applicant indicated that no objection had been taken to 14.1 A, B, C, but only in relation to D. Can I flag up at this point, because the consequences hadn't dawned on me until I'd seen 14.1 C, that certification of the environmental statement, which I understand to mean the whole of the environmental statement and everything it contains to within the DCO, could be problematic, and hence having a specific approach to list either particular paragraphs within that document or particular plans within that document, whether they be drawings or management plans, it remains a preferred approach. An example of what can go wrong if the environmental statement per se is incorporated into by analogy a planning permission is a case called Kent No. 1, where the Secretary of State consented to judgment because the ES had been included within the planning permission and it rendered the planning permission a nonsense. So an approach to particularity would be encouraged. Going back to our submissions in relation at this stage to our requirement 8.1, again, that's an example of if you're going to have a construction traffic management plan, one should have a reference to the draft construction management plan in requirement 8.1 as defined, and then have shall include all those other components, because you have, as I've explained, the document here consulted on, and then the downstream decision maker has clear framework in due course to consider further detail. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response to that?
Thank you very much. So on behalf of the applicant, responding to those points, really firstly via a question, so far as this requirement is concerned, the approval is by the planning authority, and really NRW's points would be satisfied if it were understood that NRW would be consulted as a part of that approval. If NRW think that it's insufficient for that just to be inferred, then no doubt between Powys and NRW some appropriate wording could be advanced. We don't have any problem with that being included, but we'd assumed that the planning authority wouldn't go ahead on such a matter without consulting NRW. So it would be very happy to hear from those parties as to what they feel most appropriate in that respect.
Right.
So as far as the further points taken by Mr. Schwarte concerned in respect of Article 14, we note what he says, if NRW is content to provide us with any particulars as to what it considers ought to be specified for certification, going back to our earlier point, we'd be very happy to receive that, and we'll, of course, look at that ourselves also. So those are the only points I need to make in response on R8.
Thank you. Right, I'm just got an eye on the clock and just wondering as to where we are with things. And I'm conscious, I don't know if everybody else is feeling, but I'm certainly not too warm. But we've still got a little way to go. I'm happy to continue, perhaps if we just have a short comfort break now and anybody can go for a jog and warm up if they wish, and then we can come back and finish off. Though if there's a burning desire to break for lunch, then I'm equally happy for people to do that. Would you prefer to press on and get this finished? Is there a general consensus on that basis?
We'd be, so Powys kind of council will be keen for a short break and then to push on.
Yeah, fine. Right, okay. Fine, in that case, we'll, is 5 minutes sufficient for you, or do you want 10 minutes? 10 minutes, yeah. We'll break until 1:10 then. Thank you. Take your seats, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Right. I am told that the heating system has been tinkered with, so it's now actually working a little better than it was, I think. But we might not reap the full benefits of it if we're not here for too much longer. Right. I think we've moved on to requirements number 9. And PCC, we've got some suggested amended wording for this one. Is there anything, Mr. Cosgrave, you want to particularly refer to?
I think they're probably self-explanatory. So the private water, and I can't remember, because I lost my learned friend schedule, whether these are agreed or not. They're probably, there it is. It's not. So the private water supplies addition stems from what we said in our LIR, page 88. There's a little section on private water supplies, and that's the, as it were, the evidence base for that request. And the only other small point there is the addition of and vibrations, which is something this local authority has asked for in these kind of conditions before in relation to wind farms, just to be consistent, really.
Right. And I should mention, I think, as well, that in relation to R9, that in relation to the comments or questions I raised, that the applicant is happy to agree those points. Yeah. So in terms of what PCC are suggesting, any comments there, Mr. Kimblin?
So there isn't an enormous disagreement between us in this respect. So far as the 9.2G 5 is concerned, that amendment is something that we can live with. So far as 9.2I is concerned, that's something that we could live with. 9, the suggested clauses in respect of archaeology, so the suggested additional clauses, S, the methods, timing, location of archaeological investigations, and T, the protocols and program for any required environmental monitoring to be made publicly available on an annual basis, and the amendments in respect of U, V, and W, we are neutral about. We don't have any particular representations to make in that respect, but don't expressly agree them.
Right. Thank you. And the Mr. Kimblin, the Ceredigion comment. The CAMP should include details of techniques to be used in the restoration of any mire on the site affected by construction. I'm not sure whether that was what their actual intention was or not, but any comments on that?
So, we were similarly puzzled by that, but there is something which could be called a mire on site. So far as that's concerned, we think that that's likely to be included so far as necessary. Whether it's necessary to include a specific provision within the DCO, we're doubtful about, but we have no particular objection to it.
Right, thank you. So
would you like me to pick up on the NRW point as well?
Yes, please. Yes, Matt.
Yeah,
yes.
Just to get through that. We entirely agree that appropriate method statements and mitigation should be included, but what we would expect to happen is if the KEMP fails to have appropriately detailed method statements and mitigation, then it would be sent back to us for revision. So we don't have a disagreement with the principle, but we would just expect that to be a matter of normal course.
Right. Mr. Schwartz, is there anything you wanted to... You've raised that there. Is there anything you want to say?
No, sir. I think the explanation is self-explanatory, and it's part of the iterative process of clarifying the wording between NRW and the applicant. And I'm sure it can be resolved in due course.
Right. Moving on then to requirement 9. NRW have made comments there. Do you want to take us through those, Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, sir. That's a desire to be consulted, or more than a desire, we would wish to be consulted on the final construction environment management plan, because obviously it's a key measure in relation to mitigation to be able to conclude that there will be no adverse on the integrity of the River Wye SAC. So it's very much within NRW's purview. You'll see from the explanation in relation to the applicant's representation of 19 January 2015 that it's acknowledged the need to agree a final surface watering monitoring plan with us, and we've made suggestions for changes to wording, but we also note that there's a potential for overlap with the terms of requirement 15 in relation to protected species measures, and therefore we've suggested a definition of protected species within the DCO, which would probably find its way within Article 2.1. But again, I anticipate these are drafting matters which will be wrapped up and resolved in the next iteration of the DCO, and that if the applicant takes a particular issue, it will no doubt telegraph what the terms and issue are before it concludes its own version of a final draft, and that can be ironed out in due course.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response?
Thank you. We agree. We're content with those approaches which are articulated in that text, and we agree in respect of the inclusion of Schedule 1, raptors and breeding birds.
Requirement 10, again, I think this is one of the general points raised by Powers regarding amended wording. Anything further you want to say there? Right. And similarly with R11, I think, as well. Yeah. If anybody does
I'll take these hopefully fairly quickly. If anybody does want to say anything that I don't raise, then just speak up, please. Right, our 11, our 14, one. Right, yes, there's something I raised. The appellant's happy to accept that. Habitat management plan capitalised and whatever. Reference to draft, no reference to draft. PCC suggested amended wording again. Is that a similar point?
Yes.
Right. R15.2. NRW, I think.
Yes, sir. Just in passing, you'll note by contradistinction to other requirements and in line with the principle that we've been encouraging, requirement 14.1 refers to principles set out in the draft habitat management plan at appendix 11.2.1 of the environmental statement, and that's an example of expressly incorporating a draft management plan text into a DCO, which the applicant therefore is already doing. We'd just like to see the same apply to all those sorts of plans with the same degree of specificity. And will assist as has been indicated as far as we're able to. In relation to requirement 15.1, you'll see that we've set out in the table that we made a written representation at certain paragraphs, and that was sent out, I think it was on the 18th December 2014, and it's now February 15, so some time has passed, and we've set out our approaches in relation to requirement 15, that it provide for update surveys and mitigation of European protected species, but there are some species present on the site which are nationally protected, so there needs to be an amendment to make clear that the requirement incorporates measures for nationally protected species. The appendix 11.20 of the environmental statement has a draft species protection plan, so another example of a draft plan, but that's not referred to in requirement 15, and so the status of the plan within the ES is uncertain, but it may be in due course it arrives in that requirement. That plan requires additional detail to be provided within it and mitigation, including the need for compliance audits. There's also a reference to NRW's paragraph C1.39, which in summary noted that the proposal site supports a population of water voles, which is protected under the Wildlife and Countryside Act 1981, so a big statute for a small creature, because it makes it an offence to intentionally kill, injure, or take it, as in capture it, or keep it as a pet, essentially. We've said at C1.40 we're satisfied with surveys undertaken for water vole, and that we consider that adequate to inform the ES, update surveys will be required pre-commencement to ensure voles are not present in the location of works and to inform necessary mitigation, and so requirement 15 should be revised or needs to be revised to ensure for the agreement of a species protection plan prior to commencement of development. And there are various other matters that are raised in relation to reporting agreement of mitigation measures and compliance audits for water voles. I don't think in consultation with voles, but in relation to them. We've also explained at C1.41 that the Sweet Lamb Raleigh Complex landowner has constructed a number of impoundments and settlement ponds, some of which support those voles. And we've included comments in relation to the need for licensing in Annex A and Section E of our representation. We've noted at C1.42 that the environmental statement explains that badgers are on site, and we're satisfied that the survey assessment is adequate to inform the ES, and that there should be a requirement to provide a species protection plan to be approved by the county and also ourselves, NRW, to ensure the conservation status of badgers will be safeguarded, and that plan should include agreement of the area and methodology of outcomes of the survey and agreement of mitigation measures and compliance audits. And at C1.43, in relation to reptiles, again, the survey and assessment is satisfactory. The conservation status of the reptile at the site will not be affected by the development. We advise that in relation to the draft species protection plan, that it be amended to include measures for pre-commencement surveys for reptiles and avoidance and mitigation measures, and therefore requirement 15 should include provision for the protection plan to be agreed in writing by the county and also NRW. The new document handed up helpfully by the applicant today in relation to the list of agreed requirements didn't seem to include NRW at all, so we anticipate that this remains not yet agreed, but we anticipate hopefully that it may be in due course.
Right. Mr. Kimblin, any response to what you just heard there?
So thank you. On behalf of the applicant, so if one looks at requirement 15, it's headed European Protected Species. One of the essential points made by NRW is, well, there are other species to be protected, but they're not necessarily European Protected Species. We have no problem with that distinction and a means of addressing it. But what we do say is it's important that requirement 15 doesn't become unwieldy. We note, and we have no difficulty with, the observations made in NRW's written representations, but we consider that subject to the widening of the definition of protected species, that those concerns are appropriately captured in the consultation which will take place with NRW on the appropriate schemes which they'll have to approve or not approve. So in short, we anticipate that many of those concerns will be addressed when NRW is consulted, and hopefully, because they've already flagged these points up, they'll be met in any event. But so far as the drafting of requirement 15 is concerned, we consider that much of that is already captured, but we do acknowledge and agree with NRW that there is scope for widening that protection beyond European protected species, and we're happy to engage in a dialogue with NRW to find appropriate drafting to deal with that. So beyond that, I don't think I need to take matters any further or go into detail of how one deals with vole, badger, etc.
Right, thank you. So moving on to R16. PCC again suggested amended wording.
Yes, Tom Cosgrove, PCC. I think the second suggestion, taking them in reverse, I think is agreed, the F1. The first one is really just inserting reference to NRW on the basis that it seemed to us they'd be appropriate people to be involved, as it were, in the consultation, given the subject matter. Mm-hmm.
NRW have commented on R16.1.
Yes, so it goes back to the mantra of which the example is 14.1, requirement 14.1 for inclusion of a draft management plan within the terms of the DCO. These don't have to be extensive documents, but they have to be, in our submission, something. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kimblin, anything?
Said no, thank you.
Okay. R16.2, I think you're happy with the additional clause.
We are, thank you.
17.1, R19, I'm happy with those.
We are, sir, thank you.
R20, again, PCC, amended wording.
Simply just, we think to make it simpler and to set forward the proposition that there shouldn't be anything on wind turbines unless, as it states, unless there is a requirement in law
or for health and safety reasons.
Mr. Kimblin, any comments on that one?
We're content.
R22. NRW suggests that the proposed substation should be better defined in volume and location in the DCO itself.
Yes, sir. This really goes back to particularisation of the works plans. And you'll recall, at least in the TCPA sphere, that if something isn't defined, then omissions to properly define something are no excuse later for in relation to the compass of what is actually permitted. I understand that there are plans and so forth in the environmental statement, but it may be that many of those documents make their way into the certified plans or into the works plans to give better definition in relation to what it is that's being physically provided, because who's to know what may happen after today.
Mr. Kimblin, any response on that one?
It may be the cold, but I'm struggling to follow exactly what's being required of us. So I do apologise if it's me being slow. I do need some further clarification of what sort.
Yes, requirement 22 relates to construction of the substation and is explaining that it will have hard standing and electrical compound and so forth. So far as I can tie together what the substation may be, there seem to be plans of it in the environmental statement, I think. But if you put the environmental statement to one side for the time being, it's not a building that appears to have any defined compass other than finding expression here in requirement 22 as a substation. So if it's within the works, giving it, for example, grid coordinate dimensions for the corners, giving the hard standing a defined area by reference to grid coordinates, which must be available to the applicant from its AutoCAD drawings, for example, of the site, and so on and so forth, would at least give volumetric parameters, because they could be given a height, to which then requirement 22 could apply in relation to the more detailed matters of external design, appearance and finish. Conversely, if they're to be left at large, then that raises different questions.
So, thank you very much, Mr. Schwab, for that. So could I invite you to take up the DCO and go to Part 1, Authorised Development in Schedule 1, where the work numbers are set out. And it's work number 4. And the way in which the two provisions are intended to work together is that work number 4 tells you how big it is and where it will be, and that it will include a control building with a particular function. And the requirement that we're discussing is for the detail design of that to be approved in due course. So for our part, we'd understood that to be sufficient for the purposes of the DCO, so that it constrains what can be approved, what can be built, and provides for appropriate approval of the detail in due course, particularly design, appearance, etc. So that approach has been modelled on other DCOs, Clackynog, for example. And that's why that particular approach has been taken. So for the present time, we don't understand there to be any difficulty in that, in EIA terms or otherwise. But if anybody is concerned otherwise and wants to provide further information as to why that might be insufficient, we'd be very happy to consider it. But for the time being, we think that the description of work number four comprised, read alongside the requirement, is sufficient.
Mr. Schwab, you want to?
Yes, sir, we can respond in more detail in due course. You'll note in passing that work number four is defined as a substation being an enclosed area of 4,000 square metres but with no height cap on it. And then conversely, requirement 22 refers to construction of a substation and then including any hard standing areas, which seems to be broader than works number one because substation comprises itself an enclosed area of hard standing. But again, these are matters which we can communicate to the applicant in due course and they can take on board and consider.
Right. Thank you. I think it would be helpful to do that. Right, R25, PCC has suggested quite a rewrite, effectively, of R25. Do you want to expand on that, Mr. Cosgrove?
Yes, I'm happy to. So I think, as you know, we have specialist advice, and part of our case relates to cultural heritage. And I think I'm right to say I've anticipated part of the point taken against the more detailed work we require by the applicant. I may be wrong, is to kind of put it shortly, that CADU and or CPAT indicate that what is proposed is sufficient. And I think our response to that is that we as a planning authority have in addition, a particular responsibility for these matters as set out in various parts, for example, of PPW. And we are entitled and indeed required to and should take a view on these matters, and we have done. And in essence, sir, I mean, I can give you the detail, but there is more work required as set out and detailed there, which we say is necessary and proportionate given the particular facts of this case. I can either take you through those particular points now, sir, or submit in writing afterwards the reasoning for them. It may be helpful if I quickly go through them.
If you just go quickly through those.
Yes, so if we're looking really where we depart company, which is first of all at A, where we require a detailed walkover survey, and our position there is that this particular development site contains known archaeological remains, so as you know, including Bronze Age barrows and post-medieval mines and related features, and we therefore think it is important that a detailed walkover survey is undertaken to identify the visible extent of these and other potentially associated remains so that they can either be fenced off or avoided during construction. So that's the basis for that. Going on to B, which is the intrusive archaeological investigations point, that the proposed development, again, contains known archaeological remains. And the area around the development site also contains further known evidence of Bronze Age, medieval and indeed post-medieval activity. And so our view is that when you look at the material presented in the ES, it indicates that it is likely that further remains and artefacts may exist within the development site. Many of those will have above ground expression, but some won't, and will have none at all. And so for those reasons, it is important that further, we say, intrusive work is undertaken prior to construction commencing. That's the basis for that. One then moves on to C, which follows on from that, should archaeological remains be identified during such initial intrusive works, as anticipated by A and or B, then further detailed excavation recording may be required to fully address those matters. And my instructions is that that is fairly standard practice. Then, so far as D is concerned, well, the proposed development site is known to contain peat deposits. Those can hold valuable information about past environments, and so appropriate sampling is proportionate and necessary, we say. And then finally, I think E, the need for watching briefs for different areas of the development site would be determined following the completion of A and B. And again, we would suggest that is standard practice that can ensure currently unknown archaeological remains are addressed. I think the other points are fairly obvious. I can go on and provide you with the detail of the other points as well. But so that's the thrust of our reasoning.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any comments
yes,
on that?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm grateful for that run through of the suggested amendment. So we do differ as to the need for intrusive investigation as set out at B in the PCC wording. So we don't agree with that. What we do agree to, of course, a walkover survey, whether it's described as a detailed walkover survey or a further walkover survey, is probably very little turns on that ultimately. But so we say the thrust of what's aimed at in B is met by an archaeological watching brief during the course of construction, which is a very familiar and common way of approaching the possibility of archaeological remains being present at construction works without there being, in advance of that, an intrusive archaeological investigation. So we say that goes too far on the basis of the available information in respect of the particular turbine locations. So we would say, in summary, yes to walkover survey, yes to watching brief, but at the moment we suggest that the evidence doesn't support the matters set out at B and C in the PCC condition. We hear what the council says. We don't disagree that there is a need for an archaeological condition of one type or another. But we simply say that this goes too far in requiring, in any event, an intrusive investigation at each crane pad, turbine foundation, new length of access road. That simply goes too far, having regard to the available evidence. So that's really ultimately a matter for you as between those two approaches. If it's of any assistance to you, we can provide you with a draft condition which incorporates walkover survey and watching brief, but it's pretty standard meat and drink for lots of permissions in and consents in any event. So that's our response on that archaeological condition.
Mr. Inspector, could I... Sorry, did you want to go back to the Powers County Council?
No, we'll come to you, and then if Powers have got any further comments right. After you've spoken.
That's very kind of you. Professor Roger Iris again from the Cambrian Mounted Society. We strongly support Powers County Council's view on this issue, that we think that the amended version is a very sensible version to put forward, and certainly believe it should have expertise on the Bronze Age as well, because Cambrian Mounted Society is worried about the whole of the archaeology of this site, and we feel that the applicant hasn't fully appreciated the importance of the site. I don't know if you want me to go a little bit further into Bronze Age sites or not, sir. I could keep that till the open hearing tomorrow, but there's been a lot of new work on Bronze Age sites, very recent work, and it's become now increasingly accepted that many Bronze Age sites were set in relation to their landscape and the sky, and that especially for the horizons that were visible. And it's very important to find where those monuments are and to archaeologically inspect them. And it's pretty well known now that certain days, for example, of the solar year and the moon's much longer cycles were marked by aligning stones to certain horizon points. And on these points, they often put cairns and other monuments, and there's been huge new developments in research with places like Newgrange in Ireland and Callanish in Scotland and the Orkneys, where a lot of this has been done. So we fully accept what Powys said in their impact statement. and if I quote them, the exposed upland location within which these monuments and assets are situated contributes to their setting and significance in a variety of ways. For the prehistoric cairns and associated remains, the open nature of the landscape reflects the nature of the landscape at the time of their construction. It's not been altered over many thousands of years, and also its character over the millennia since their construction. And it enables us to understand and appreciate the relationships between the monuments in their wider topography, watercourses, upland movements, routes, and other related monuments. And if you add to that Bronze Age environment, the fact of the mining complexes that they've found and the designated heritage assets, I think this needs an enhanced archaeological survey, and we would strongly support Powys County Council in their view that this is necessary. It's almost, as my colleague just reminded me, a precautionary principle with such a huge major industrial development.
Right, thank you, Professor Edens. Do you want to come back on that, anything there, Mr. Cosgrave?
It's very useful to hear those comments, and also Mr. Kimlin's points. I think probably the pointed issue, sir, I think just to clarify it from Paris's point of view, is that when you look at the environmental statement and its indication that there are likely to be further remains and artefacts that exist in a Bronze Age, medieval or post-medieval context, our simple point is that a lot of those, I think experts would say, are not likely to have, I think the phrase they use, an above-ground expression, that they may well be underground, and therefore a walkover survey is not going to pick them up. And that's why we're saying you need an more intrusive survey to see if they exist. I think that's the simple probably point between us.
Right, thank you. Yes, fine, okay. Thank you for that. So moving on to R27, again, PCC have suggested some amended wording, which NRW is in agreement with. Anything you want to say there? You agree? Good. R28, again, suggested amended wording, which NRW is in agreement with. And you agree that as well? Good. R29, R31. PCC suggests a new requirement to replace 31-35. Well, 31 is, this is the noise.
That's the noise debate I think I cunningly avoided this morning first off. Right. So
I think we've covered that. Yep. Good. R35, R36, R37, Mr. Fuchs, I think you'd raised comments about community liaison. Wish to see wider dissemination of scheme there. Is there anything you want to say on that?
Yes, yes, please, sir. I don't consider that a liaison with just the local community is wise enough with it. There's mention of to ensure residents. I think that community liaison should include those with all interested parties, the likes of me, who lives just outside the area, and representatives from amenity users, such as the Ramblers, Ramblers Cymru, British Horse Society, Pentip and Lemon, Cambrian Mountain Society.
Right, thank you. Mr. Kimberlin.
Thank you very much. So we note those comments. So, community is something to be understood rather more broadly. I understand why you say that. The approach to drafting such liaison schemes is something that can be approached in a broad manner, and I'd be very surprised if anybody who wanted to take an active interest would be turned away. So I wouldn't feel discouraged by that. We note the point.
Okay, thank you. That then concludes the requirements. Then move on to additional matters and suggested requirements.
Mr. Asquith, could I very briefly, before we leave requirements, take you back to requirement 18, which we were able to just move past. And that, just to remind people, is about appearance. It says the wind turbine shall not be erected till details of their external appearance and colour and surface finish and design and appearance of the external transformer, etc., have been submitted to and improved by the relevant planning authority. Now, of course, we're all familiar with that kind of wording, but I just ask you to reflect briefly on the answer that Mr. Kimblin immediately and straightforwardly gave me to my suggestion that the first people would know of the precise turbine to be erected was when they're delivered to the site. Now, I just ask you to reflect on an inconsistency there.
Right.
And, of course, Powys County Council, in terms of the requirement.
Is there anything you want to say by way of response? Right, okay. Right, in that case, number 36, not requirement 36, but schedule number 36. This is just relating to modern day drafting, and I think the applicants are content to look at the whole DCO with that in mind. Yes, the various suggestions here. PCC, Mr. Cosgrove, do you want to comment on your suggested an addition of a requirement there?
Yes, so, I mean, the general point here is one to do really what's generically known as benefits, which has troubled some decision makers in the planning sphere. But the simple point is where a scheme such as this puts forward various benefits, which all are said likely to occur and benefit the community. Some, of course, may be relevant and referable to the development and properly taken into account by decision makers. Some of them may be benefits, but not necessarily referable to the development. What we've done in our suggested requirement, which is, I think, going back in our appendix to 22A, which I think so you've set out, actually, in your agenda, is, I can put it this way, I don't pretend it's actually the tightest or best requirement I've ever seen. It comes from a recent inquiry that the local authority had for quite a large wind farm, which is now before the Welsh Government, and that was a form of wording agreed between the appellant and the local authority, in that case, as a sort of mechanism to make material things which could be properly referable and related to the development for the decision taker to take into account, and at the same time provide some security as to it being achieved. So that's the basis for it, sir. That's why it's there, and we think the wording there would properly be material to your decision. And I know, I think the applicant, sir, has suggested in their deadline 3 material, a broader form of wording relating to the establishment of a community benefit fund pursuant to Section 2 of the Local Government Act 2000. I think the only issue with that, from our point of view, sir, our submission would be that in that form, depending, of course, what the agreement said, I suppose, and depending on what the community benefits are, it's the detail, but in principle, there may be issues there with how material some of those funds are to your decision-making. The final point I make is that, as you know, often these things, when they are proposed, are done by way of obligations rather than requirements. And there is some guidance published by the planning inspectorate on that, but making really the same point that if it is to be done by way of Section 106 agreements, it has to be set out how such matters are relevant and how they are directly related to the development. So that's really our point. So I accept it's something we've raised in the first instance in our LIR, if something should be secured. So we've opened the can of worms.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin.
So may I close the can of worms by agreeing to PCC's suggestion?
Drafted it more broadly, so I think that's it's too easy.
Right, very good. Thank you. Right. Moving on then, 38. This is a comment from Kiridigi on the requirements should include a provision that exposes the applicant to statutory noise nuisance action should a nuisance arise from amplitude modulation. Any comments there, Mr. Kimblin?
Could I invite you to hold that one over to when we discuss noise?
Fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. 39, again, covered again. Loss of peat, habitat management plan does not appear to be creative in terms of positive enhancement. CCC would wish to see the creation of a peat restoration area together with its future management and mitigation for the loss of peatland. NRW have commented... this is covered by the habitat management plan.
Yes, sir. We are seeking further information from the applicant, but as in generally this iterative process, we're optimistic of getting that, and it's really to ensure that there's a commensurate relationship between lost peat and likely impacts.
Thank you. 40. NRW requirements should be included to minimise the impacts of the developments on bats. We think we've already touched on this. Anything further you want to say there, Mr. Schwart, on the question of bats?
Only very briefly, the position, as I understand it, is that within in the TCPA planning sphere, over the last year or two, numerous developers have agreed to imposition of a bat condition, and we can provide examples in due course of that. And we're seeking a similar sort of condition, but as a requirement in relation to bats. We disagree in relation to the veracity of the bat data that's been provided previously. We'll continue to work with the applicant to see whether matters can be resolved appropriately and through the provisions of a requirement.
Thank you. Mr. Kimblin, any response on that?
But this is about curtailment or not. So in the event that there was a bat risk which was demonstrated by the survey data, we wouldn't have a problem with curtailment, but that's not the present state of the evidence. And so it is an evidential issue. As has been indicated, it remains a subject of discussion. But for present purposes, we are very clear that the survey evidence doesn't support that position. In the event that discussions produce another conclusion, then you'll be invited to include a requirement for curtailment. But that remains to be determined.
Right. Kim. 41, NRW, possible need for requirements to secure appropriate sampling and risk assessment in respect of possible contamination in respect of a tip within the proposed compound boundary. Anything you want to say there, Mr. Schwartz?
So again, that's an iterative process. We've been provided with further information by the applicant, and we're in the process of considering it.
Thank you.
So can we just clarify the position there? As we understand it, this is directed towards a particular part of the site, and we understand this to be directed towards the upper car park where the site compound would be. If that can be confirmed, then specific measures in that regard can be accommodated. But if it's broader than that, then we're likely to remain in disagreement. So we just need very specific indication of where the concern is said to be.
Right. Do you want to enlighten us on that, Mr. Short, at the moment, present?
So it's currently under consideration, and the applicant's request for refinement in relation to the geographical area of the requirement will come out of further consideration of the material that's currently under consideration, and we'll let the applicant know in due course.
Right, thank you. 42, NRW again, possible requirement needed regarding surface water contamination.
As I understand it, the same position applies in relation to 42 as it does in 41. We're currently considering further information helpfully received now from the applicant.
Well, sir, but I think we could take matters further than that. So far as surface water contamination is concerned, we're, as you know, quite content to undertake appropriate sampling for relevant parameters. Indeed, that there is also requirement 9, which points in that direction. So I don't think that there is any real difference between the parties in this regard.
So that's helpful clarification, because NRW didn't feature at all on the new document this morning of what was agreed and what wasn't agreed. It would assist if perhaps potential draft terms of requirement could be provided to us, and then we should be able to resolve precise terminology in due course.
Right. I'm sure, Mr. Kimberley, that can be arranged. Yeah, thank you. 43, post-consent monitoring for red kite, is a requirement needed? NRW reserving its position with regard to the need for this requirement until you've reached agreement on the habitats scoping report and bird survey.
Yes, so there is a difference between the applicant and an NRW, but NRW anticipates that further dialogue would help clarify that difference and therefore that item.
Oops. Right. Nothing further you want to say then on that, Mr.
Well I will say something. Red kites, we have been monitoring for a very long time, and we don't have any concern in principle with further monitoring during the course of operation. But it's really a question of what it is that would satisfy NRW. So we do wonder whether or not there's a need for this to feature in the DCO. There are lots of provisions already within the DCO to deal with ecological matters and schemes to come forward. Whether this needs a further addition to the DCO is something that we question. But for your notes, we have no difficulty in principle with red kite monitoring during the course of operation.
Thank you. 44, I think we may have discussed that already. Possible need for requirements to require consultation with NRW regarding micro-siting to protect the River Wye SAC.
Yes, sir. This largely arose out of the discussion under limits of deviation.
Yeah.
And in a nutshell, the derivation of the issue is goes back to the Section 42 consultation, where there seems to have been radio silence, as I understand it, from the applicant when they were asked for further information. So the debate about refining how one microsites inside the limits of deviation has remained at large until very recently. And so we're trying to rationalise that and resolve it. And we hope in the ongoing dialogue with the applicant that can be addressed in discussion with NRW.
Thank you. And Mr. Kimblin, anything you want to respond? No. 45, need for a peat management plan. Well, I understand the applicant's working on that at the present. Anything further to be said then in respect of that?
DCO. I apologise, not for the purposes of the DCO, no. Thank you.
46, PCC, requirement needed to ensure that micro-siting should not be permitted where this would move a turbine closer to a public right-of-way. You've responded to that.
Already covered, I think, in our early discussions.
Yeah. Good, thank you. Welsh Government has raised various requirements regarding transport arrangements. Believe the applicants are considering those. Yeah, that's still a position. SNAP suggests the need for requirement regarding amplitude modulation. Does that come in within your
sorry, does
comments
if we,
about
if we may,
noise?
Thank you.
Yes, fine. And 49... alternative car park location for horse riders has been offered by the applicant. I question whether a requirement is needed to secure its provision. Do you want to comment on that?
Sir, I can report happy news that we're content that such provision be made. So we question whether there's any need to trouble the DCO on this topic. But if somebody wants to talk to us about its location, we'd be very happy to take part in that discussion.
I think the reason I asked whether a requirement was needed was how is it going to be
secured,
yeah.
Yeah, very well. Yeah. So the first step is to decide where. So that's a discussion which needs to be undertaken.
Right. And in terms of time scale for looking at that, what are we talking about?
Well, it has to be done very quickly. in the order of 14 days, I would have thought.
Right. Yes, Mr. Cosgrove.
Just really to voice Powers, Tom Cosgrove, Powers County Council, our support for the need for a requirement, I think, to secure it. I may be wrong. I thought there had been provisionally at least a location mooted, which I think was outside of the application site, but all the more reason for it to be secured if that be the case. But I hear what Mr. Kimlin says, but in principle we think it would require some security, and probably by a requirement.
Mr. Kimlin? Yes. Right. Thank you. And then finally, no, not quite finally, on the schedule, number 50, off-site planting. Would a requirement be necessary to secure this? NRW have commented that no location has been identified for off-site planting. It is likely to be outside the application boundary and outside the control of the applicant. Unclear how a requirement can secure this. Is there anything further you want to say on that?
So what I would say is that we've reflected on this further, and in our view, it's difficult to show a need, in fact, to do that. It's not, in fact, something which is necessary. So, and in that context, this issue doesn't arise. If anybody wants to persuade us to a contrary view, we'd be content to hear what they have to say. But it would be off-site and would need to be secured by a mechanism probably outside of the DCO, Overall, our view is that it's not necessary.
Right. Anybody want to comment on that? No? Okay. And then just on the NRAs, NRW rather, it's getting late. I'm cold still. NRW's schedule, number 20, you're suggesting a provision is needed in the requirements for pre-commencement peat and habitat surveys to inform micro-siting. Understand the applicant is willing to agree this. Anything further you want to say there? No. And then finally, provision needed for requirements for pre-construction BERT surveys to inform avoidance and mitigation measures. Do you want to expand on that at all, Mr. Schwartz?
Only to perhaps refine that if construction is likely to commence in approximately 2018, but actually the applicant seeking 8 years to implementation, construction may not be likely to commence in 2018, but sometime much, much later. In either event, NRW was seeking an updated baseline in relation to birds.
Mr. Kimblin?
So we can see the merit in that.
Right, thank you. Well, that completes our troll through my schedule as amended by NRW. Are there any other matters specifically that anyone wishes to raise regarding any aspect of the DCO? Mr. Kimberley?
So no, thank you very much.
Right. No. Right. Good. Thank you. Right. Just then to wrap things up, next steps, timetable for the examination, Wednesday the 11th of February, that's next Wednesday, that's deadline four, that's the deadline for any post-hearing documents, including any written summaries of any oral cases that have been put today. And then by Wednesday the 4th of March, which is deadline 5, the applicant should provide a revised DCO taking into account any of the issues and comments made today. There will be an opportunity to comment on that revised DCO. That date is Thursday the 26th of March. That's deadline 6. And following this, then I may issue a revised draft development consent order on or before the 24th of April. That's deadline 7. And again, that would be taking into account issues and comments that have been made. And again, there's a further opportunity for comment on that, and that's deadline is the 14th of May, that's deadline 8. Right, I don't think I have anything further particularly to say at this stage. Just going back, apart from one thing, just going back to a point that was raised, I think, by Cambrian Mountain Society early on this morning. Regarding comments, being able to make comments. I shall be asking for, well, putting out my second written questions shortly. And at that stage, I'll probably also ask for whether there are any comments on things that have been, comments that have been made at deadline 3. So hopefully that might accommodate your concerns in that regard.
Very much so, sir. Thank you very much.
Good. Okay. Right. Sorry. Yes, Mr. Cosgrove.
So you remember, sir, I rather sort of dived in at that stage and sort of made what was a half-hearted application, I think, but to deal with the ability for powers to respond to those matters I identified, which we see as raising new issues. And I invited you to perhaps consider allowing us to get a response by deadline 5. And as I said, so it may be that those are matters you pick up in your questions on the 18th of February, but they are clearly matters we, in any event, would wish to have an opportunity to respond to in the way I described earlier. And so I'd just invite you, if you would, to recall that we are allowed to do that and that we provide you and indeed everyone with the comments by deadline 5. That would seem to be a sensible timescale.
Okay, thank you.
Sir, on another procedural point, I hope I'm not out of tune in asking you whether you have decided about future issue-specific hearings. And one thing I did want to mention to you was that I have looked through the written representations, and it does seem to me and to the Cambrian Mount Society that although we asked you for an issue-specific hearing just on TAN 8, that much of the argument has already been rehearsed to you in representations about TAN 8, the legal framework and also representations from the county councils and from voluntary bodies. But it may be that you're thinking of a wider issue, specific hearing than just on TAN 8. But I don't know what the applicant feels, but if you were going to have an issue-specific hearing just on TAN 8, I do wonder whether you've got enough detail already, although we're very happy to have an issue-specific hearing on it. I'm not saying that we don't want it. I just wonder what whether you would learn anything new from it.
Right. Well, thank you for that. Mr. Kimblin, I don't know whether you've any thoughts on that at this stage.
So we do have thoughts. We consider it would be of some assistance to both you and the Secretary of State in due course to explore those issues at an issue-specific hearing. And we, frankly, are anticipating that there would be one.
I think it would be slightly wider than just TAN 8. It would be the whole sort of policy framework.
Well, we're very happy with that. Yeah. I just didn't want us to have an issue-specific hearing as we had asked for just on TAN 8, yeah, when you'd had a whole range of representations already on that. But no, we're very happy to deal with that sort of issue.
Right, thank you. Good. Mr. Cosgrove.
We will be quiet, I'm sure, eventually. So can I just, as I understand the timetable, on the 18th of February is when you issue certainly the confirmation of the date, time and place for further issue-specific hearings. And so that would be the time, presumably, when you identify what the
yes,
hearings
what
would be
about. Yes, what they
would be, yes. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, yeah. No, that's fine.
And finally, I promise, sir, on the question of the accompanied site inspections, the situation is gradually resolving itself, I suspect. But in relation to the first one, I had a very fruitful interchange with the applicants about the itinerary. A very early stab was made by them and me on the second one. Could I suggest to you that perhaps the most appropriate thing is for me and other parties to continue to exchange ideas in relation to the remaining site visits with the applicants, and then when we've reached the nearest we can to some kind of consensus, then is to enter into a dialogue with you about how that's to be conducted and indeed when. My thoughts are at the moment that we may be able to do the resumed first inspection and its wider context successor in that week towards the end of March that's already been set aside for that purpose. And indeed, it may even be possible and sensible to do the site-based one first and the wider one on the following day. And my feelings, without having really discussed this properly, are that there is a distinct possibility that we may be able to telescope the second one into one day. I think I understood you to say at the start of this morning that you'd made an informal tour around of some of the wider viewpoints and that sort of thing, and whether we need to know which of those you feel that you might not need accompanying on, that's up to you. But it certainly occurs to me that as time goes on, the task will become simpler rather than easier.
Right. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Sinclair.
Simpler and easier.
Yes. I'm quite happy for you to continue dialogue between you as to accompany site visits and site inspections and suggestions for those. What I would say is that a lot of the viewpoints that have been suggested and are visible from public rights of way and public access land, which I would be able to do those visits and visit all those viewpoints and sites myself anyway, with unaccompanied. So please just bear that in mind when you are sort of talking between yourselves in terms of helping the timetabling of the examination. There's plenty of time for me before the end of the examination to view things. And if you specifically want me to do accompanied visits, then think about why they specifically need to be accompanied, bearing in mind, of course, that on these visits, I'm not able to hear any discussion or debate regarding the merits or otherwise of the case. Simply, if you want me to make sure that I see particular aspects, then that's a reason for being accompanied, or of course if we needed to go on to private land. But I'm just making a plea that bear that in mind when you're discussing things.
Yes, it's interesting you should say that. It's my experience generally over the last few months even, that the concept of site visits seems to be subtly changing at public inquiries, whether no matter by what means they are determined, in that a preference is being expressed for the need to constrain them purely to those where accompaniment is essential in terms of visits to private property. In the past, it's often been the case, in my experience, that inspectors quite prefer, in some cases, to go around viewpoints, even though they may be publicly accessible, in order to ensure that they're getting the appropriate feedback at those views from people who've read the environmental statement or even suggested them. And while I'm not wanting to sway your hand as to how you do these things, I had rather anticipated that you might be wishing to ask questions of various parties at different viewpoints as to was this the slightly different variant that they'd wished you to look at, or matters of that sort. But I entirely leave that to you. And as far as I'm concerned, I've had certain ideas about how the remaining viewpoints might be more easily done, and whether that's achieved by a formally accompanied site inspection or whether it just helps you in your own deliberation, that's really for you to determine, but I'm helpful to work on that basis.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sinclair. Mr. Schwartz, did you want to say something?
Yes, sir. Two matters. One is that NRW obviously has landscape as one of its key concerns. Please may we be included on the iterative process of organising itineraries, routes and so forth. And secondly, in relation to the DCO, can we request please have a Word version of it sent by email perhaps, so that we can then add potential track change suggestions to it as a document rather than exchanging simply pieces of paper. Of course, the applicant may do what it wants with it, but it would help to have that as a start point document to work with.
Fine. I think that will be helpful, and I don't anticipate any particular problems with that.
Right, well, just remains to thank you all for your various contributions today. No doubt I shall be seeing some of you tomorrow, and probably a chance for you to go and get suitably clad and in readiness for tomorrow, if it's going to be as cold as it is today. But right, so it's 10 o'clock start for the open floor hearing tomorrow. So thank you all. Goodbye.